Ladies and gentlemen, I call this September 21st Board of Supervisors meeting to order. We'll begin with the pledge of allegiance, followed by a moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Do we have any changes we need to make to the agenda? All right, do we have an adoption of the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, just have a few things to report, a couple repeats from previously, and just some reminders. So one, we got a new employee starting at the sheriff's office as a deputy sheriff. Dustin Herndon started September 12th, so we're happy to have him on board and filling up. I think the sheriff's department, I think he said at some point, I think he's about 100% full right now with positions. Or yep, so we don't want to jinx anything, so.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah. The drive-through rabies clinic will be Saturday, September 24th. Again, it's going to be at Pleasant Grove Park from 9 a.m. to 12, from 9 a.m. to noon. It's a $10 cost. Dr. Jim Starkey of Tucker Veterinary will be doing that. You know, ask that individuals and their pets remain in their vehicles. Vaccines are good for 1 year, and 3-year vaccinations are available. And they just ask if you want to get your pet vaccinated, please pre-register in advance. You can go to the website fspca.org, or you can pick up a hard copy application at the FSPCA. So this Friday, September 23rd, at approximately 10 a.m., Dominion Energy, their Bremo Power Station, has been pretty much mothballed and dormant now, a non-used energy facility for, gosh, I want to say probably 4 to 5 years at this point.
At least this.
So this Saturday they will be doing a controlled implosion demolition of their facility down there at Bremo Bluff. So Friday, September 23rd, approximately at 10 a.m. There is a weather delay date for Saturday. There'll be closures in the area. So Bremo Road from about the Bremo Post Office to 1268 will be closed starting at 9:15 a.m. And the James River will also be closed from the Bremo Bluff Boat Launch to about a half mile downstream. Reopening of those areas are anticipated around 11 a.m. And I know Dominion has one, they've sent out some social media stuff. They sent letters out to constituents and nearby property owners, and they're doing a lot of their due diligence to make sure everyone is aware. So, and then just some upcoming board meetings. Wednesday, October 5th, we have a 5 p.m. regular meeting here. Wednesday, October 19th, a 7 p.m. regular meeting. And then Wednesday, November 2nd, we have a 5 p.m. meeting. And I'm happy to answer any questions the board has.
Any questions? I'm going to add one thing. Anyone wishing to volunteer to help get tires off the river, we are going to do a cleanup, and they're looking for volunteers just to help load them from the canoes to the trucks.
Ravana River, James.
Ravana. We're going to go from about a mile south of, or east of Palmyra down to Red Bank Lake. So,
what's
Saturday. And we're going to start at 9 o'clock.
This Saturday.
But we're looking to get out about 2:30 to 3, and they were looking for anyone who would be interested in helping. They said the last time they did a stretch a little further west, they got about 80 to 90 tires off. And they were just looking for folks to help us get them up the back.
And is there, just so we can get it out, is there an organization that's doing it, or any?
Ravana
River Basin Commission?
Or Alliance, which one is it? I can't remember that.
Okay.
We've got people to go down the river to get the tires, okay. But they're looking for people that if anybody would be willing to volunteer to help get them off the river.
Okay.
When we're done. So if you're interested, contact me.
All right. Good. Nothing else from me, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thanks to Rivanna River Alliance, Rivanna Conservation Alliance.
Oh, yes.
And Rivanna Conservation Alliance, I believe.
I bet you Kelly will know before.
I bet you Kelly will know before I'll know it.
Aaron's.
Conservation Alliance.
He says yes, right.
Go, there you go, Conservation Alliance.
I could never remember the middle word. All righty. Any other comments on the board? All right, hearing none, I will now open the first round of public comments. Anyone wish to address the board, please state your name, address at the microphone. Keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Step forward if you'd like to speak. Yes.
Good evening. My name is Rachel Farrell, and I live at 107 Riverside Drive. My family moved to the Riverside neighborhood of Lake Monticello from Hampton Roads this past May. I want to take a few minutes to thank you for the resolution tonight to vote on the VDOT roadway safety assessment and present some thoughts on why this matter should take priority with time and assets. Last Tuesday afternoon, I was leaving my home during rush hour for the first time since moving out here, as I'm often home with my children. I waited at River Ridge Drive on the non-gated side almost 2 minutes to make my left turn onto South Boston, a turn which neighbors have earnestly likened to gambling and called truly an accident waiting to happen. I watched not one but two near accidents happen right in front of us, and in the aftermath of my shock, I've unmovably resolved to try to help this stretch of road become a much safer thoroughfare. I can't see that my children are ever getting driver's licenses until it is. Indeed, one of my neighbors has even had thoughts of moving out of the neighborhood before her child learns to drive, stating that it's just too big of a risk. And yet another mother shared with me last week that her son does not even want to practice driving with his learner's permit on account of this very left-hand turn. This ought not to be. To say I've never experienced anything like this intersection, and specifically the left-hand turn from the ungated side in all my life, is no exaggeration. There's no margin for computational error or hesitation. Even if the brush has been cleared, a driver has to begin counting how many cars have to pass the beginning of the S-curve to calculate a break while continuing to glance east and north to check for cars from those directions, while remembering how many cars are in the part of the S-curve that you cannot yet see until they pop within view about 2 seconds before crossing the intersection. If a car pulls up who is not turning, he then has the right-of-way, according to Virginia law, but compounding this issue is the fact that drivers fail to use turn signals and even forget the rules about who has the right-of-way in the first place. Sometimes the right-hand turn lane headed west is used as a passing lane for people turning left in the through lane from South Boston to River Ridge Drive. If someone without a barcode doesn't remember to not turn in there, I've seen a work truck driver have second thoughts, continue in the through lane, and then almost get rear-ended by the next driver coming westbound at 50 miles an hour. It's also frequent in bike pedestrian traffic, with youth crossing on foot and bikes. On behalf of my neighbors, I respectfully submit to you that this safety study is long overdue. The next day after this experience, I called and spoke with our administrator, Mr. Dahl, to discuss what could be done. He encouraged me to contact VDOT, saying the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and so I decided it would be my duty and joy to reach out via social media to the community. In the past week or so of so doing, there's been an overwhelming response of exasperation at the problem and gratitude that this issue is once more being addressed. To all of us, it's an urgent matter of preserving life and well-being that is deserving of any and all resources of time and funding allotted to it. VDOT guidelines state that prior to the field review portion of a roadway safety assessment, stationary video for a minimum of 15 to 20 minutes to observe and record varying traffic conditions should be collected. I pulled some of our neighbors through our Facebook group to ask when they felt the most dangerous time was. The overwhelming answer was weekdays between 7 to 9 a.m. and 4 to 7:30 p.m. I ask that you please insist of VDOT during the data collection phase that footage be taken during these times. I would like to take just a few moments to share with you some of the comments from our community about this matter. Number one, I almost got hit by a speeding pickup last week. He hit his horn, not his brakes, and was most definitely speeding. Number two, I'm on Riverside Drive. If you could hear folks hitting the Jake brake around the curve at Buck Island, my neighbor across from us has folks hit her fence out there 3 to 4 times a year. Number three, if I'm riding my motorcycle, I always go to the slice gate no matter what time it is. Number four, there have been uncountable accidents and even deaths at this intersection. It's mind-boggling that nothing has been done to make it safer. Number five, nighttime is easier for me because I can see headlights. Anything between dawn and dusk is difficult, whether you're turning right or left. It's always a crapshoot. And number six, I was broadsided by a car coming out of the Riverside gate. It never stopped. It came through the gate and kept right on going 4 years ago. I spoke with the lake's general manager, Mr. Schotter, yesterday morning, and he affirmed that there have been discussions about trying to enhance the signs as well as to make something more apparent about the gates and GPS software. I told him convex mirrors would help greatly. The state no longer provides these, and Mr. Dahl seemed to think they might be the responsibility of the lake since the use would be from private roads. Please include these ideas in your future conversations, as well as painted crosswalks, reduced speed limits, flashing lights, and a four-way stop or traffic signal. I ask you on behalf of the residents of Lake Monticello and Fluvanna County to commit to making a total resolution of the infrastructure here of highest importance. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
I had a question to the board. If I remember right about that study, none of us will be participating in what's in deciding what's in the study, correct? It'll be an outside group deciding.
This is something different. This is specifically a VDOT study. VDOT does specific safety and speed studies in county roads. This is separate from
the study of last.
That's different from the TJPDC kind of overall community. This is specific to a specific roadway.
Thank you.
Now the information could gather what's gathered could feed into the overall study, but this would be something more specific to this stretch.
I normally don't say anything, but I will tell you this. Last week, I was pulling out on the school bus and taking a right at about 3:10 in the afternoon. And as I took my right turn, I looked back over my shoulder to my left, and a car came around the curve. They had plenty of time to hit their brakes. Instead of hitting their brakes and slowing down behind me, they shot into the southbound or westbound lane and passed me on a blind curve. So
I'm just trying to understand. So if it's off of private roads, then what effect can the Board of Supervisors have on what she just mentioned?
So from the private road standpoint, so again, this would be a safety study looking at the stretch of road and you know, speaking with Scott Thornton with VDOT, and again, we've got an agenda item to kind of go over some of this, but speaking with him, you determine the stretch if you want to look at. So in the agenda item, I'm proposing we look at from right before Broken Island Road, where the big curve is, where you get lots of cars running straight off that corner right there, to going down to probably where about Lake Monticello Road is.
Gotcha.
And so they'll look at that whole stretch, looking at from visibility, speed, you know, is there signage that they could do? But also, going back to your question about private, you know, as I was talking to Mr. Scott Thornton with VDOT, what he said was, he's like, normally they wouldn't do something like this because it is private, but he's like, they've just done something similar with Lake of the Woods up in Orange County. Now, it would require some coordination with Lake Monticello, and I already spoke to Tom Schotter, the general manager there, just to kind of give him a heads up on this, and, you know, from his standpoint, obviously he can't speak on behalf of the board, but, you know, he said that he couldn't imagine that the lake wouldn't be willing to cooperate with whatever comes out of the safety study.
And I'm going to suggest again, don't stop right there. Come up the hill behind the lake to Crofton section. I pulled out of Crofton this afternoon, and I have no idea what the line of sight is to my right, but I'm peeking between a tree and a fence to my left to make sure nothing's coming. Nothing's coming that way, so I started it coming out, and here comes a dump truck. Now I had to slam on the brakes, slam it in reverse. Thank God nobody's behind me.
Well, when
the Crofton section is no joke either.
Yeah,
Crofton, Monish, Riverside, they're all bad.
They need this.
Yeah,
you know.
For sure.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, that for the speaker's edification, the last board meeting, the board voted for a study through the TJPDC for the purposes of potentially getting grant funding that would allow the use of those funds that are separate from VDOT funds that might address some of those intersections, and we specifically mentioned those intersections. There isn't a time that VDOT doesn't show up that I bring up that intersection as well, because I live right there. And you know, I've had plenty of encounters myself, as has my wife and my daughter. So it is a really important thing. But we've been hamstringed because it is public-private kind of combination here. So it's great that you're putting the efforts out there to get people out and talking in the community about just how dangerous it is.
All right. I apologize for taking up too much time during public comment. Is there anyone else here that's wishing to speak at this time in public comment? I apologize. Like I said, I don't usually say something. I felt moved at that.
Good evening, Board. Good to see Mr. Sheraton, Mr. Dahl, Ms. Booker, and Board members. My name is Bruce Bowling. I'm not a resident of Fluvanna County, but I'm the pastor of Columbia Baptist Church, located at 116 Ravanna Street in the great town of Columbia, Virginia. Good evening. My 5 years I've been here as pastor of the church, it's been an amazing thing because I've learned so much, got to meet some folks I've known before, and some new folks. It's been a wonderful thing, and it just amazed me about the history here in Fluvanna County and just the things that I have learned over the last year and a half. Ms. Tricia Johnson has been helping us with the Freehill Cemetery with the cleanup, and then just the things that I've learned about where the church actually sits at, and then just in general throughout the county. It just amazes me that we have this great history, we have this great information here in Fluvanna County. And so I come before you all as the pastor and of the church, and I have heard what some of the congregants have said about the area and they feel like, or how they feel about the area. And if I may read, I believe this is a mission statement that you all adopted in 2016, and I believe you all are working on another one, but it reads, it says, Fluvanna County is committed to providing an excellent quality of life for our citizens and businesses through the delivery of competitive public services and programs in an efficient and effective manner. In talking with the members of the church and then in some of the other surrounding areas of Columbia, one of the things they were talking about was care for the children. They were talking about care for seniors and transportation. And was curious about maybe trying to revive and bring things back in that area, because it's hard for some folks to go up to, let's say, Zion's Crossroad to do some shopping. It's hard for some folks to go up near the lake to go to the food line. And so these were some of the cares and concerns that they have expressed to me. And I feel like that I'm kind of behind the game by not necessarily or not doing this earlier, that maybe I should have done this earlier and spoke up for the folks. And so though now they just wanted to reach out and they brag about Fluvanna County and they love Fluvanna County, but they also want that part of the county not to be forgotten. And so we know that as businesses leave areas, then people leave areas, and then areas tend to die. And so they just want to have this voice and just want you all to hear and just to get together, maybe possibly meeting with the representative of the area is fine, and then just talk about like some strategy of bringing businesses or maybe transportation back to that area. And I know that this is a tough time, this economy with the virus going on, things have kind of shut down, but just to have or come to the table and have a conversation and to hear from those folks. Because, you know, and what I did was I asked a couple of members of the church that are involved in the county, you know, some work in the schools, some work with Parks and Rec, some in the county who have children. And it's pretty much been the same concern, the transportation and things for children to do. And, you know, because we want our children not to be in trouble. We want our children to be successful. It's kind of hard when things are against it. And, you know, maybe not as easily accessed to them as other parts of the county per se. And so, you know, we just want to express that and just reach out to you all, the great folks here on the board, and you know, just thank you all for what you do, and just ask for maybe just a moment of your time, just to sit and talk and discuss on some possibilities that we could do, that we can help serve, because you know, to follow along with your mission statement, and then, you know, we love to hear that, and that's inclusive of everybody, not just, you know, kind of leaving out this particular area. So I just want to thank you all for your time again. You know, good to see you all, get to see some of you all again as well, and thank you for your help though. Back a couple months ago, and so appreciate it. Thank you all.
Yes, sir. Anyone else?
Good evening, board, chairman. My name is Corbin Flynn, 319 Shiloh Church Road. I'm probably going to be a little repetitive, but I'm going to go back to your last meeting, September 7th, and you guys spoke at length regarding the minutes of the meeting. You talked about how the minutes are just a summary of a meeting. Either Mr. Dahl or Mr. Payne, I might get them confused as far as some of their comments go, but they sort of left the onus on you supervisors. Ultimately, it's your choice, what you feel is adequate, even though you don't prepare the minutes. And I know Ms. Solis and before her, someone else prepared them, but over the last couple few months, I know they've been critiqued. I know they've been put off and altered as a result of that. I don't know for a fact. It's my opinion that Mr. Dahl and Mr. Payne have a significant amount of input in how those minutes are then delivered to you guys for you to then pass. The last meeting, one of the comments that Mr. Payne made was the word funeral was irrelevant. And yet, I went back another time. I said 5 years before. So you can't go back past 10 years. On your website, you can't pull up minutes in 2012. So I went all the way to 2013. Over 200 meetings you guys have had. Ms. Booker was the only one that was here on the board back in 2013. So four of you were around. How many times have you amended your minutes in over 10 years? One time. It happens to be the June 15th meeting. Yet it's irrelevant? Or it's just a summary? There must be some purpose behind that. I feel like that purpose has been conveyed to you folks, and then you folks went ahead and passed it, and then the minutes from, I think it was the August 3rd meeting where I brought up that concern. You waited to let them be passed this past meeting on September 7th. And you, at one time, the word that they wanted to put in there for me was contextualize. And I get it. It's a summary of minutes. But it's being driven. The narrative is being driven by what's in those minutes. Either they are important or they're not important. They can't be both. They can't be, well, it's not a big deal if it's adequate, if it's a summary, and then turn around and amend something that you haven't done for 10 years. 23 meetings a year, is that what we have? 10 times 23 is 230 meetings. Almost 230 meetings, and you've done it one time. The reason why I know that you can't go back past 2012, because I had a little bit of extra time this morning. I wanted to go all the way back before Ms. Booker came to see if it had been done since you've been here, ma'am. But I couldn't go because the website doesn't show it. And that's okay. I'm sure it's an archive somewhere. But, you know, what is done in these meetings matter. It is a big deal. What this board did, and I'll call it, it's my opinion, and I think it's a valid opinion, in the invalid June 15th meeting, authority has been shown. You guys haven't shown the authority. It's Mr. Payne's opinion that you guys have done it okay, and you've accepted that. But you don't have to accept just his opinion on it. You haven't shown any facts that that meeting was okay. So the June 15th meeting, when that project comes about, that's going to affect not just me, it's going to affect other property owners. I built that thing 20 years ago. Mr. Sheridan came in last meeting, and he was running a few minutes late, and he's like, could there be 10 more minutes in a day? Because you work hard. You work hard for a reason, to take care of your family and to build something for your family. This board, in a matter of 2 hours' time on June 15th, you took that 20 years away from me that I worked hard for and the people around it. Several of you have mentioned that. You knew that it was a problem. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else present that would like to speak in public comment? Okay, is there anyone online that would like to speak? I see Ms. Curley. Ms. Sandra Curley.
Yes. Good evening, Mr. Chairman, board members. Sandra Curley, tax map parcel 1715X. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. In response to my public comment number 2 at the September 7 meeting, Fred Payne was adamant to assert that you had a written policy in effect for electronic participation at the June 15, 2022 meeting. The following day, September 8, I emailed the Board of Supervisors and requested a copy of that policy. None of you responded to my email. I replied all to that email on September 15, reminding you that I requested a copy of the policy, had not received it, and informed you that if you were intending for someone in the administration to provide the copy, that you would need to forward the email to that person for them to respond. Once again, none of you responded to my email, and no one provided a copy of the policy. I again replied all earlier today. Still, none of you responded, and no one provided a copy of the alleged policy. So that makes 3 emails in 2 weeks requesting one policy, receiving 0 response. My request for the policy came because of discussion within this body at the last meeting. I stated the authority of my assertion that your June 15, 2022 meeting was invalid is Virginia State Code 2.2-3708.2C1, the one that was in effect until September 1st, 2022, and the one that the June 15 meeting fell under, clearly states that you must have a written policy in effect. I restated this in my email to you and included a link to the state code. At the meeting, Mr. Payne said that he could no longer allow this falsehood to persist and that you had a policy in effect. However, no one will produce said policy. During the discussion of September 7, Supervisor Fairchild alluded to one enclosure on the issue. The June 15 meeting took place 3 months ago. Its validity has been challenged during and since the June 6 meeting. You claim to have a policy that can potentially bring the closure that you all seem to desire to the issue, yet you fail to provide it. Mr. Payne was clear that he felt that it was Corbin Flynn's opinion that the June 15 meeting was invalid, and that Mr. Flynn stated no authority. It is also my opinion, and I stated authority, not only in the meeting on September 7, but also in the meeting on August 17, and I provided you with a copy of said authority. So now I will make it clear that it is Mr. Payne's and the Board of Supervisors' opinion that your June 15 meeting was under a written policy that allowed for electronic participation, but you have stated no authority because you refuse to provide a copy of said policy. Because you said so does not cut it. I have provided my brief, my authority, which happens to be state law, yet you refuse to provide yours, which in my opinion leads me to believe you're hiding something. There seems to be no other rational reason you would not provide a policy that you referenced having and that you believe could bring closure to this issue. I want to see your authority. I showed you mine, now show me yours. And before you assert that I should file a FOIA to get it, I filed FOIAs requesting information in the past, but I should not have to file a FOIA to receive a policy that in a meeting you referenced having. It seems petty that you have a copy of a policy that you referenced and a taxpayer asked for 3 times, but you refused to give to them. That is not transparency in government. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. I see Ms. Brittany Gray.
Good evening, Brittany Gray, 2 Watt Circle, actually in the Riverside section. So just wanted to share my feedback. I've actually lived in Riverside on and off for 25 years, and also wanted to share that it is certainly a concern. Pretty much any which way you're coming is a danger zone. So I don't have the answer or any sort of suggestion other than maybe a traffic circle. I'm sure people would hate to have that, but I think it could be good to slow down with the curbs coming around the corner there. But I just wanted to share that it is a concern for my family as well.
Thank you, ma'am. Is there anyone else online? Anyone else in the building? Seeing none, I will now close the first round of public comments. There are no public hearings, so I will now move forward with action matters. A, requesting part-time temporary clerk position be classified as permanent part-time deputy registrar position. Ms. Pace.
Good evening. Okay. We are asking for a part-time permanent position. What we have now is a clerk acting in this position, has been in this position, doing this position for a number of years. And so we'd like to have that position classified as permanent part-time. As you all know, that the climate in the politics has really changed dramatically. The voters have a heightened awareness of the election process. They are calling or and emailing and requesting FOIA requests. We have a lot of individuals with, you know, just calling for information, which is very time consuming. We have a dramatic increase in mailings by third party organizations, and that causes a lot of confusion. We have to take time to answer questions from voters when they get conflicting information coming from a third-party organization. We're required now more than ever, I'm sure you know, with cybersecurity awareness, that we have to be on our up and up with knowing and being aware and watching out for fake emails and such. We have to participate in webinars and tabletop exercises and conferences with the Homeland Security, with the FBI, with cybersecurity and infrastructure security, a lot of these organizations, as well as with the state police. I'm just trying to keep up with all of those. It's very demanding. It's hard to operate an office with two full-time people and a half part-time clerk. And to service the citizens, we have at least, we have near 21,000 registered voters. So it's very, very, it's different. I've been in this game for, you know, for a long time, since the 80s, and seen a lot of changes. So we just cannot handle the magnitude of work we have with the personnel that we have on board at this time. We are having to do certification with equipment. If you see here on the screen that we have an increase in registered voters since 2015, we have 16,711. And in December of 2021, we had 20,347. So we've got inactive voters that reduced our numbers in 2015. But as you can see, the trend, as we go down and look at what went on in 2016 prior to the no excuse voting early, we had 13,668 total voters that voted in that presidential versus the 15,933 voters in 2020. So in the gubernatorial election, we tried to give you some facts there for 2017, where we had 9,244 total voters, and in 2021 we had 12,491 total voters in that election. So the election laws have increased since 2017, and the responsibilities that come along with those law changes make the processes more complicated. Now this screen is not correct. We gave you another sheet with the corrected amounts. We switched there was a mistake made, and just to show you that in this graph, in 2016, the number of early voters we had, which were absentee voters at that time, versus what we had in 2020, skyrocketed.
And one thing we'll do, me and Ms. Harris, so I copied the whole board package to my laptop, and she just updated the thing in the package, but so anyway, we have a, what you have in front of you is the correct copy, and what we do normally, we have presentations that we post after the fact. We'll post the correct presentation.
So basically the red and blue got
flip-flop.
The orange, yeah, the orange and the blue did.
Or the orange,
yeah. On the 2020, yes. Yep. Sorry about that.
And it's 178%.
No, it's 453% increase.
Yeah.
453
and yeah, this is correct.
178.
Yes, ma'am. And so this is another graph, kind of splitting it up from 2018 to 2021. And you can just see the significance in the increase of voter participation, which is good, but it's hard on a staff of 2.5 people and one being a temporary part-time person. All right, so some of the changes in the processes are that we have to handle an application, a single application, more than once. I mean, it used to be you registered them into the state's database and you were done. But now we're having to handle those applications more. We have to scan them. If there's someone that has an issue with their application, we have to try to contact them. A lot of times we don't have contact information. We have to send letters and hope that they will respond to them. We have to put them in an incomplete file until we can get those applications rectified. Absentee balloting now has changed so that voters have a number of days to get that ballot corrected. We have to contact each one of those voters if they didn't complete the back of their envelope, didn't have a witness, or for some reason that ballot is incomplete. It's called a curing system, a program, where we have to notify the voter as many times as we can before the canvas is completed to try to get them to come in and complete that ballot, and then we can process it. So we're making phone calls, we're sending letters, we're doing a whole lot more to just get that voter's vote to count. We have to keep a log of all of that, and all of that has to be in a way that it's open to the public to see what we do. We have to implement a pre-processing program where we are processing ballots, absentee ballots, before the election, which we go to the point of having to check also for those, opening those outer envelopes, making sure that they complete the ballot envelope on the back and that they don't have to be cured. If they do, then we're contacting them, trying to find them. So it's a lot of tedious work behind the scenes that the average voter wouldn't know of. A whole lot of this, because of early voting, has changed the life of the registrar's office. So the 45 days prior to is just like having an election day for 45 days. So you're preparing everything over, so kind of like Groundhog Day. You're preparing the same thing over and over, and the accuracy that's required takes manpower. We work long hours. We even had in 2020, we had workers that ended up in the hospital. So, you know, you can't operate an office if you don't have trained personnel to step up. Even for me, speaking personally, I've had some personal issues in my family where I had to be out of the office. Well, if I don't have someone trained that can carry on, it takes more than one person to operate an office. So back to me to tell you all about my personal life, but just to point out that we need to have trained people that are reliable and dependable in the office to run it. It takes all year to operate or to hold an election. And so you can't just ask for part-time clerks that come in one day or twice a week and not know how the office operates. And you have to have someone that's trained and know how to continue the process if I'm out or if my deputy is out. Let's see. So, and we did some comparisons with other localities, and so for us, we have two permanent positions and one part-time temporary. In Amherst, you can see where there are 22,630 registered voters there. They have a full-time permanent person and two part-time permanent and three part-time temporary seasonal people, and they use them as needed. In Botetourt, 26,000. I won't go and read all of them, but you can see the comparison that we did. Everybody is fighting their own battle because all of this is new for all offices. So we're all out here trying to get support, trying to get the for you guys to understand, for the public to understand that we're in a different season and we need personnel, reliable, trained personnel to keep the office running and to meet the needs of the community. Any questions?
When did your staffing level go to what it is today?
It's been this way for a long time. The person that's been doing the position that's a temporary part-time has been doing what I'm requesting, but they've been doing it maybe 10 years, but never recognized and as, you know, just always as a clerk and not recognized as a position that's been done on a ongoing business.
And I think one thing to answer, so she's got two full-time positions that pays herself, plus an additional person. That second one was converted to full-time, I want to say, 5-6 years ago, maybe?
Maybe longer, but I had two. We were
on the board.
Yeah, I think it was a 30-hour a week position, and that position moved up to a 40-hour a week position. So, mm-hmm.
And then, so there was an increase then.
What's that?
But there has been an increase.
A number of years ago.
Yeah.
So it's but since 2015, though.
Yes, and then the early voting.
And then we got hit with the 45-day.
Then the 45-day early voting, and that's when the levels haven't really changed. She's bringing in some more temporary people periodically just because you have to have them during the 45 days, but more of a consistent permanent position that hasn't been there. And so the position that's there, it's a temporary part-time position. She's requesting a permanent part-time position. There's someone in the position, and really what it does, it's probably a little more consistent hours. It would be required consistent hours, and there's some part-time leave and vacation accruals allowed with that position. That's probably the biggest difference.
They've been doing the job as needed, but they've been serving doing 20 hours when we're not in season, and then 40 plus hours when we're in season. So that person's been doing this job for a long time.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this question. I know when we moved you over to the new office, and I saw the guys moving the desk, I came over. There were more than three of you in there. What's the most you have working at one time?
Early voting that particular year, it could have been as just temporary people for the early voting. Could have been.
Yeah, because that was when
15
we got
plus.
It was like four or five folks were in there.
Oh, lots of people because they don't all work the same schedule.
Now, will we have this year where a person can come in and register and then vote?
Same day registration, yes,
yeah.
Ma'am. That's
so
another.
You see what I don't see where that may not be a big handle because a lot of people don't even know that you can do that.
But they will know that.
I know. Yeah.
I don't know that it'll be a big impact this year, but next year for sure.
Yeah.
Like you said, a lot of people don't know that law was passed. But.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another thing to keep up with all the laws.
Yeah.
It's constantly changing. You have to keep personnel up to date. it's just, it's very challenging to have, it would be very challenging to have someone just coming in every so often, where this person has been working at least 20 hours a week and more for a long period of time. So they know exactly, they can pick the ball up and run with it if something happens to me.
Anyone else?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve the reclassification of the temporary part-time registrar clerk position to a permanent part-time deputy registrar with the additional funding to come from FY23 personnel contingency.
Second.
Motion is made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Seeger. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Thank you very much, Mr. Basin.
Thank you all.
B, authorization to advertise a public hearing for noise control ordinance. Mr. Dahl.
Yeah, I'll go through a little bit of this, but I'll probably be phoning a friend here with Mr. Payne, and then we have
I see we have a guest out there. We
do have a guest. David Wells, and then we got Captain Peterson here. Again, you know, prior to Mr. Wells leaving Fluvanna County employment, not leaving the county. You know, him and Mr. Payne and the sheriff and Mr. Haysop, they were really kind of working on a lot of this noise ordinance. And so I think both of them will kind of tag team. You'll probably want to come up to answer any questions, but really the purpose of this action would be to provide for a new standard for review of noise complaints with the sheriff, please, will be easier and more equitable to enforce, as well as substitute civil penalties as specifically authorized by statute in lieu of current criminal penalties. And again, really staff is requesting authorization to advertise for a public hearing. Public hearing would be October 19th, and what this is doing is repealing the existing noise ordinance, chapter 15.1, and then adding chapter 15.2 to regulate excessive noise and activities and provide for penalties and violations. So from a presentation, that's what I have, but from a ordinance standpoint, I mean, we can certainly bring up the ordinance, and I know Mr. Fairchild had some questions earlier, and I think Mr. Payne and the gentleman out in front probably answer some of these as well.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can pick up the ball here. This ordinance has existed for some time. I think it was adopted in 2001, and it has been some degree of problematic the whole time. The main thing that happened was in 2009, there was a Virginia Supreme Court case from Virginia Beach that declared a standard like the one we had for what constituted unlawful noise to be unconstitutionally vague. So with that in mind, we went back at about that time, about 2009, and the basis of the Supreme Court's opinion was that the standard that was used of a reasonable person does this, and it was a reasonable man standard, basically. That's very common in legislation, but the Supreme Court decided to hold Virginia Beach's feet to the fire, and they declared it unconstitutional. So we had to go back to the drawing board because ours was probably indistinguishable. And what we did was we adopted some very specific and quite rigorous testing. What it amounted to was we adopted a set of standards based on decibel counts with sound meters. And I was and am firmly convinced that that standard would be upheld by the Supreme Court under the Tanner case or otherwise. Problem with it is that it turned out that had certain practical deficiencies to it. And the officers can give you a good description of this. And by the way, former Major Wells, this was kind of his baby, so I was basically writing down what I told him right there. But the thrust of it was that in order to take the sound reading, you had to take two different readings. One was the sound without this intrusive sound about it. So typically, in a residential context, it would be early in the morning, late at night, or something like that, where there wasn't a lot of traffic sounds and stuff like that. That gives you the baseline. And then you have to set up the equipment while the noise was going on. You had to set it up certain distances away from it and a certain height and various things like that, which are prescribed by the manufacturer of the equipment. And what they were finding was, number one, they didn't know about the noise until it was too late to get a background reading. And then after that, it took a long time to set it up. And it was hard to do sometimes because, you know, it's a lot of training to operate these things. And again, by the time they got readings, a lot of times the noise would be done. So what Major Wells did was he went out and found an ordinance which had what I consider to be an easily defensible standard that didn't involve taking measurements. And that was that if there are certain kinds of noise it applies to, certain kinds it doesn't apply to. So for example, it wouldn't apply to a fire engine siren. And there are a number of other things. They are specified in the ordinance. They are those exclusions and specific things that are covered are similar to what we have in the existing ordinance. We've tweaked those a little bit because over the passage of time, we've gotten better language for it. But the two big things it provided for was for the specified kinds of sound. If the noise can be heard from inside the residence of a neighbor with the windows and doors closed, it's too noisy. And simple as that. I think that's a perfectly defensible standard. The other thing we did, but it's easily enforceable because they call the sheriff, the officer could go in, stand there in the living room and say, get all the doors closed and windows closed. Now can you hear it? And if you could, it would be a violation. The other thing that is really a substantive change, and there are a number of small changes, but I won't get into all those tonight, but the other change is the penalty, because the original ordinance prescribed as a class one misdemeanor, which calls for up to 12 months of jail and a $2,500 fine. It was obvious to me, and I think the officers would agree, that no general district court judge is going to put somebody in jail for a simple noise violation. If it's that bad, we got other remedies we can use, like injunction and things like that. The second thing is that since we adopted that ordinance in 2009, there's a statute been adopted which specifically enables the county to regulate noise. And part of that ordinance is prescribing the penalty. And the penalty prescribed in that statute is it's a table or whatever they call it, set of standards for fines, civil fines, and no jail time. So I think the officers agree with me that that's a better penalty. It's more reasonable, and it's much more likely to be effective enforcement. So remember, you're not talking about whether you're going to adopt it tonight. You're talking about whether you're going to submit it to public hearing. But the sheriff has asked for it, and I can endorse this draft.
I'd like Monticello Police Chief asked for it too.
My special guest.
Do we have any questions from anyone about this?
No, it only applies to residents.
I wouldn't dare ask the lumber people behind my house who's cutting down trees out there at 6 in the morning. I wouldn't dare. I'm just happy they're not throwing any trees in my yard. that's not covered in here. I mean, you don't want to stop someone's work. I mean, they have to get out there early.
Well, there's some time limits on that.
Yeah.
The time limits, not time limits on construction.
Right. I think I see some six when they're construction. Yeah. So there. And I see it's nine, but they're out there. Six. But that's going to happen when you're in certain areas.
Just give you a little anecdote personally. One of the things that's exempted is lawful use of firearms, except during closed hours like at night, things like that. This past Saturday was the second Saturday of dove season, and the farm up on 600, mm-hmm. that it's a big farm, and you could tell they were going to have it because they cut the crops in strips. And I had to go by there later in the morning, but I knew it was there first thing in the morning because it woke me up, because the shooting was started early, and I heard it and realized what it was, and it would have been lawful under this ordinance, assuming the timing was right. I think it was, but that's the way it would work, and I think the officers need it, public wants it, and I think we ask you to order it, put the public in.
Any questions? Anything else?
So I think this came up in large part because of some people in my district at the end of Poplar Spring Road down near Scottsville had a concern about a neighbor who they felt was doing a lot of different things that were obnoxious and loud, which included firing off a weapon after 12 a.m. And Eric was good enough to, I asked him if he could meet with this community, and we met at somebody's house, and a pretty good portion of people came there. And Eric expressed the struggles and concerns with, for example, you know, somebody shoots at 2 a.m., but you're not there, and they set two shots up in the air, and by the time you get there, they're not doing it, and how do you enforce some of this? And enforceability seemed to be one of the struggles, the common theme. And every citizen there made it clear, we moved to the country for certain freedoms and abilities that we wouldn't have if we lived in more dense areas. And so it's a real struggle of limiting what people can do in a country that's really it's very traditional things, and protecting the abilities of quality of life for their neighbors. And so I've just got specific questions. So I was confused to the firearm piece of it, especially since that was the part of what brought this to the table. And my eyes were dilated today. And then my seat where Mike is now used to have a lot more light, so I struggle a little bit. Specifically prohibited, number 8, the discharge of firearms for target practice, function testing, or recreation between the hours of 9 p.m. and 7 a.m., except as exempted by the provisions of section 15.2-7, which says firearms, by the way, under exempt sounds, firearms, the lawful discharge of a firearm, except as prohibited by the provision of section 15.2-6-8, which is the one I just read. Do I understand right that says that Flavanna citizens can't shoot a firearm until 7 a.m.?
You can't shoot it for the enumerated purposes. You can't sight it in your gun if before 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
You can't go out recreational shooting. You know, some people like just plink cans and things like that. The other is function testing. So you broke your firing pin, you got it fixed, and you want to check and see if it works. You can't do that. The other things that you can do are all otherwise regular. So for example, a burglar comes breaking in your house and you have to defend yourself, that's not covered.
Hunting's got defined hours by a half an hour before sunup, daybreak, and a half an hour after sunset, I think.
Well, that's true, except for like coon hunting. Coon hunting is at night.
Correct.
So that sort of thing is already regulated by state law.
So state law supersedes no matter what we would say, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Because I just, the word recreational, the question came up today, well, isn't hunting recreational? And
it's not intended to. I think everybody on this board knows, and I'm not about to regulate hunting excessively. And that would be against my disposition.
And actually, that was part of my response to it, was that you're a big hunter. But again, I had a hard time answering and saying, well, no, hunting wouldn't fall under recreational. But I understand, as being a, correct me if I'm wrong, as being a Dillon state, we couldn't regulate it anyway, correct?
It has its own set of regulations.
But by state law, we couldn't do anything that is more restrictive than the state.
So we couldn't do anything. I don't think we could do anything on this one.
Okay.
My only exception about the shooting of guns is we might want to put something in there about New Year's Eve.
Well, I think there's an exception.
At midnight, there's been known to have a few guns go off.
Yeah, but that shouldn't be happening. With that kind of celebration shouldn't be happening. You want to make some noise, that's one thing, but you ought to be using carbide cannon or blanks or something like that. It's dangerous to shoot up in the air. Especially
back to 4th of July.
The intent of the recreational was shooting just for the sake of shooting, not for hunting. Is not, to me, not recreational shooting. Hunting is a separate, distinct activity. We're talking about the guys that probably have a couple beers and go out at 2 a.m. and decide they're going to dump a magazine just because they can.
And I do get that. While vague words in law can create concerns.
I've had to take care of keeping my chickens alive.
That is a lawful purpose.
Chickens and, oops, there's a possum in there. So that's dark. Is it okay if I kill the
possum? That's a lawful purpose, yes, ma'am.
Kill permits, probably.
That's a defensive property.
That's a what?
Defensive property.
Okay.
Did you go out of
pack? Oh, well.
Major.
I used to 410.
Oh. If somebody has a kill permit for their crops or something of that nature.
Yeah. They're allowed to use spotlight. Maybe the wording was misconstrued. It was solely for the recreational shooter, just when they go out and decide at midnight they want to start testing and tracing rounds.
I just bought this gun. I'm going to go shoot an entire cliff.
Well, one thing that's gotten very popular is people with particularly 9mm pistols like to go out and see how fast they can enter the magazine. And they have 15-shot magazines, bang, 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 bang. And that's, it doesn't have any purpose to it. The guy just wants to operate. Now, I don't have a problem with you know, playing cowboy as long as it's safe. But it's also, that's a nuisance to your neighbors. That's what we're talking about.
And what about animals? I saw something about barking. We used to have a lot of that problem, people with dogs.
I think we excluded barking dogs because of the nature of it.
I didn't see.
It's not in there.
I don't think that's in there.
It's not a
I
did see one.
It's excluded. Sounds
like sound of animals is excluded.
That's
excluded.
Right. Oh, but it's, I did see something. What did I see about that?
It's in 15.2-712.
Because there's some annoying roosters that go off before 6 a.m. or 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And the problem with barking dogs is how do you differentiate between the dog's going to bark and the habitually a barking dog? That's like my current position. That's one thing I'm dealing with. But we deal with that on the policy side. But, you know, what's the, every animal's going to bark if someone comes in your driveway, drives by, but the dog just sits there all day and barks habitually. So that's why that was intentionally left out of this code.
I can tell you mine. I know when I got a coyote in the yard, because mine are outside and mine will go nuts when a deer or a coyote tries to come.
So just basically, Mr. Payne summarized everything very clearly, was under the old statute, we had people come to the magistrate who had documented habitual problems with their neighbors who were intentionally or being just disruptive for the sake of being disruptive, and the magistrate looking at it like, well, what's your best of meter readings? And the part with the equipment is just purely unenforceable.
That's the part I remember. Y'all came to us about, and we all...
Yeah, and I've been trying to do this for four or five years, because people get very annoyed with law enforcement. Like, yes, it's annoying, I agree with you, but I can't do anything about it because the code is written poorly. So the intent was, at least if the people have the documents, they come to master and get a summons. It's not a class one misdemeanor, which is way too excessive for this type of thing. But we've had literally calls where people like, you can't enforce it anyway, so what are you going to do? And they sit there and crank it back up and rev their engines and just be very unneighborly for the sake of being unneighborly.
And again, I get the intent, especially because of that having on Poplar Springs Road that kind of spawned a lot of this. I just, while at the same time, those people were saying to me, gosh, let's be careful what we're asking for. And it's notable to me, 15.2-5, prohibited noise generally. No person shall permit, operate, or cause any source of sound or sound generation that is audible in any other person's residence with the doors and windows to such other person's residence closed. That means, and of course, like Monticello, let's spread it out a little bit, and Fox Hollow, that if you're in your driveway talking and I can hear you in my bedroom, that does fall into that description, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Why wouldn't it? That I shouldn't permit you to hear it inside of your closed house.
Put it in the definition section.
Where?
Which one, Fred? Which definition?
Noise.
Well, noise is right here under four.
Yeah, four.
Any source of sound.
Well, if you have a neighbor that's talking in his driveway and you can hear him in the house, so that, it's notable, he's either talking pretty darn loud or you've got a very close quarters.
I would disagree. Again, I'm even spreading out from Lake Monticello, which I can tell you, having lived there most of my life, I can hear people talking in their driveway, and this applies to Lake Monticello. But you stretch out to Fox Hollow, which is one bigger lot. Now, what if you're waxing your car and you have a radio lightly playing outside, or what if you're playing cornhole in your backyard? And
a radio is defined in here.
Okay. Where?
That's 15.2-6. Number 5.
Again, the noise has to be excessive, not just commonality type of noise. This was adopted from the Loudoun County ordinance.
I'll say though, 15.2-6 doesn't say excessive.
I'm sorry?
He said it has to be excessive.
The definition of noise
is excessive. 15.2-6 does not say excessive. Well, it says any noise.
Yeah, but if you look
noise
here,
is by definition above excessive.
If you look right here on the screen, number four, the definition of noise means, the term noise means any sound which is excessive.
I see.
Which is trying to balance everything out the best you can in this type of situation. That's why we kind of looked around for some that have stood some legal tests, and we found the one in Loudoun County and kind of based it off of that model.
Well, there are going to be variables in this, and I don't see any way to avoid those.
Yeah.
Because, for example, my house is particularly well built, and a lot of times, if we have doors and windows closed in our house, and our dog's in the backyard, we can't hear him in the backyard. Now, that's not true of a lot of houses. So there's going to be variation on these things. But I don't have a standard that would be meaningful and useful that would be any better than what's here.
I do get it. I can just imagine over the next days hearing from constituents going, what? You said I can't do what in my backyard? And I just want to be able to understand it and defend it.
Well, there's not much that you can't do. You can't do it at certain times of the day. Like...
Or night.
Well,
a lot of it does say after 9 or so, it prohibits it. But I had not picked up on that piece about in excess or whatever it said, that in the noise definition.
So from the enforcement side, for us to go out there and take a complaint, that's the first thing we're going to ask. Excessive, and what, articulate that to us, what's excessive, because obviously we need probable cause that it was excessive. And even if they go in front of the magistrate, they're going to have to provide that. Like, were they whispering? They're whispering. We're not going to enforce this action, obviously.
Yeah.
You go before the magistrate's going to say, give me the details of what happened. If they were whispering, the neighbors were just whispering, versus they were screaming at each other and doing other things, and obviously that's excessive. There's more going on than just screaming back and forth. So,
yeah.
But the key word in that is the definition of noise, and which is our key one of the, as you look at it, element of, it's not criminal, but element of this action. The definition of noise will be our key deciding factor on how we enforce it and how it goes in front of the magistrate.
It does. I was in Lake Monticello a few weeks back at nighttime, and there was a person across the street on the phone just blasting the F-bomb, screaming at somebody and so on. And I thought to myself, these people have a right to call Lake Monticello police and say something doesn't feel good in the neighborhood. So.
All right, and we're just doing this so we can have the public hearing. So,
correct.
You know, this is just opening door for those folks that want to come in and tell us how they feel. So,
okay.
Any other questions? Do I have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve an authorization to advertise a public hearing for an ordinance to repeal Chapter 15.1 of the Flavanna County Code and add a new Chapter 15.2 in its place to regulate excessive noise and attract and activities related thereto, and to provide for penalties for violations thereof.
Second.
Motion's made by Mr. Fairchild, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. And I do have to tell you, my neighbor is listening tonight. One day his wife looked at him and said, you need to go over there and check on Mike and the family. Somebody's screaming. He goes, no, that's just Mike singing while he's cutting the grass. Thank y'all.
Thank y'all. Nice to hear you.
About 5 minutes to 7, to quarter after 7, I know two school buses pull in and out of Riverside. If you ever have an officer, have the opportunity to sit over there and just watch some of the chaos sometimes, because I've been passed twice.
I do not have enforcement authority on South Boston Road.
That's okay, but you... you can scare the mess out of them. A lot of times, a little bit of fear
goes a long way. Not as long as it used to, but.
That's true.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
I agree with that one. Thank y'all. Next up is C. Revised Board of Supervisors mission statement, Mr. Dahl.
Yeah, so a little rehash at the planning retreat. You know, there was some discussion about, possibly, adding some language to our existing mission statement. So the current mission statement, which was adopted in 2016, says Flavanna County is committed to providing excellent quality of life for our citizens and businesses through the delivery of competitive public services and programs in an efficient and effective manner. Now, a lot of the discussion, A lot of the discussion around the first part of that, talking about committed to providing excellent quality of life for citizens and businesses, the board generally was fine with that, but it was more the latter part of the mission statement, talking about competitive public services and efficient and effective manner. So after kind of going back to the drawing board, and Ms. Harris did some wordsmithing on this for us here a little bit. So basically number one, option number one here, and these were in your board packet. Option number one, again, the letters in red represent what is new. So the first part is the same that we currently have. It says Flavanna County is committed to providing excellent quality of life for our citizens and businesses through the efficient delivery of core, we said competitive before, and now we said delivery of core services and programs while preserving the unique identity and rural character of the county. So that's that. The latter is kind of what changed. Under option two, again, the first part is still the same. And just the letters in red talk about Flavanna County is committed to providing excellent quality of life for our citizens and businesses through attractive, efficient, and effective core services and programs while preserving the rural character of the county. So that's that. I think my mouse is going dead. Option three talks about, is basically the same as number one above. The only difference is it really puts the statement in the present tense versus the past, you know, whereas option one says is committed to providing, whereas number three says provides. We're just getting ready to say Fluvanna County provides an excellent quality of life. We're doing it now, and that's kind of what the statement says. Under option four, option four is really the same as number three above, but we just get rid of citizens and businesses. So option four is Fluvanna County provides an excellent quality of life through the efficient delivery of services and programs while preserving the unique identity and rural character of the county. So again, you know, we kind of heard the board trying to include some language. You know, we talked about, you know, the county's identity, talking about the rural character, and option four just kind of really streamlines things, saying we provide an excellent quality of life right now. And so those were the four that we came up with. Again, trying to not change it dramatically, but kind of hear what the board was kind of requesting and kind of wanted to see in there. So, or if there's something, some other variation, but I thought we came up with some good alternatives to kind of what is currently there. So that's kind of what we have for the board. I know the board said they wanted to look at revising it, and so those are the options that we came up with.
Is there one that sticks out to you?
I think one's pretty clean and clear, and I like that it's to the point. It says core services and programs, which is what government should be about, and it commits to preserving, as they all do, our rural character.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Booker.
What does unique identity mean to you?
Oh, sorry.
To me? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's it's, unique identity?
If we're not like Charlottesville. We're not like Alamo.
Well, I was sitting on the end of a fishing pier this week.
You were what?
Literally, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, I was sitting on the end of a fishing pier. And I go all the way to Nag's Head. First guy I stopped and talked to lived in Shannon Hill. The second one I talked to at the bait shop lived in Amelia. And that's one thing that we were talking about, you know, our rural character. One stoplight. And Amelia goes, well, we got one flash caution light. I said, yeah, you got more than us. I said, do you have any traffic circles? So we got three of them. So we were just comparing, and I think that's what the unique is. And unique, I know we're not unique. I know this is rather narrow-minded of me to say, but I think we've got a great core group of people that live in Fluvanna County.
This is God's country.
I believed it my whole life. That's why I'm still here.
My opinion is that, you know, the mission statement should be short and sweet. And again, I've said this before, I think that we define the character and the goals of the county and our in our comprehensive plans that we upgrade every 5 years, and I just don't see the point of making the change myself, but I'm not voted on that, so that's just my opinion.
I know three is short.
Well, the only difference between one and three is the word committed. Mm-hmm. And I, when I looked at it, I said one or three. I could live with either one.
I mean, I could.
We're splitting hairs talking about the difference. But I like what you said. One talks about how we've been that way for a long time. We have. But somehow the use of the word committed, like I think I might need to be committed.
You might what?
Need to be committed.
Is that what your wife says?
That's what my wife tells me that quite often.
I'm good with either one. Provides is current, so it's mm-hmm. It's a little... I feel like committed is more of what is our mission. A mission is to do something different, to forge forward on something.
So and you're thinking number three then as well, since with the word provides, well, talking about the future?
I think committed is more towards the future. It's more, here's what we're committed to for our future, compared to, hey, we're already doing it on number three. But I'm okay with either one.
All right. Well, I mean, I don't care.
I'm still a fan of one.
I mean, I think the challenge is, you know, are you going to be called hypocritical when you have, you know, commercial and industrial growth happening in certain parts of the county? Are they going to say you're not committed to the rural character of the county? you know, because you put this in your mission statement. We define that, again, in our comprehensive plan through our growth areas and say, here's where we are going to have that kind of growth. So for me, again, the argument of including a phrase in a mission statement, which is then later identified somewhere else, is a mistake. And I certainly would say that the word committed highlights the fact that you are, in fact, being hypocritical if you pursue down those roads and allow for growth in those areas.
I would say in anything that would come in front of me on the board, it will be vetted in part to how it affects our unique identity and rural character of the county.
And I would say that I would vet it against how it helps to improve and maintain the core services and programs for the county and preserve the citizens at a cost-effective and efficient manner. Yeah, that's what I would say.
And that's why I said in part, because there are different items that I would vet towards it, and this is...
All righty. So we know we're not going to come up with one that's going to suit everybody one size fits all. Do we have a motion for any of these?
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt the revised mission statement, option number one, as presented.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion is made by Mr. Fairchild, seconded by Mrs. Eager. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-1. All right, next
Mr.
up.
Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. O'Brien was the only nay. D, 2022-2023 Board of Supervisors 2-year plan, Mr. Dahl.
Well, Ms. Harris.
Ms. Harris.
I mean, if you'd rather have him, I'm okay with that.
We can both do. We'll have her start off.
Good evening. Seems like it's been a little bit of time since I've been up here. I'm going to keep it brief, so now it's up to you to keep it brief. So, I am happy to bring back a cobbled together version of the goals and plans that you discussed at the retreat on August 27th. It looks similar to what we've done in the past with the strategic initiatives, but if you've been around me at all, you know I like to say they are neither strategic nor initiatives, so we like the goals and the 2-year plan. However, I'm not wed to it, so if you want to call it something different, I'm open to that too. Maintain the same categories that we had with the strategic initiatives, although I did change one of the categories slightly, community development. I forget what the whole thing was now.
It was community development, economic development, and tourism, and we tweaked the community development and enrichment. It's kind of encompass a little bit of everything.
Sure.
Yeah, it seemed to, we were having some trouble getting everything in there or making it fit in the other categories. They are laid out exactly the same. The only difference that we added this year was we indicated whether they were going to happen in year one or year two. Of course, year one, we only have a few months left of that, so that is the end of 2021. And year two, 2022, and then 2023. Anything happened in the last 2.5 years? It could have been 20 years ago or 6 months ago. I'm completely confused on the year. So the same numbering. We've added a column for whether it's been completed, identified the goal and the category that's under, whether it's going to happen in year one or year two, and then whatever notes that might be beneficial.
Or both years.
Or both years.
It'll happen.
Or both
it'll
years.
Continue to happen.
And one other change before we start going through the rank. Would you advance one, please? Just
yep.
One slide or two. So whereas before, some of these categories, some of the identified goals, there might have been 3 identified goals. As we looked over them, we realized some of these actually went together. So in the project management, just using the Palmyra Village streetscape as an example, review and pursue opportunities and options for Palmyra Village became a subset of the Palmyra Village streetscape with the second one. So we cobbled them together, put them where they fit, and moved along. So let's go through them, remind you of what you discussed, and also bring it to the attention of the public for the first time. I can't read what's on my paper, so I'm going to apologize for looking at the screen while I do this. We kept A1, worked with the FRA, the Fire and Rescue Association, to identify support options for fire and rescue volunteers. whatever specific goals there might have been under that probably won't happen in 2020. Whatever this year is, what is this year? 2021?
2022.
But we'll start after the first of the year. So don't be laughing at me. So that it got moved to year two. A2, perform comprehensive review of existing partnerships with local area support and nonprofit groups providing services to Flavanna residents, review service gaps, and identify needed partnerships. That was added, the identifying gaps and needed partnerships. There may be folks who are doing work in the county that we haven't identified that don't come to the interagency council meetings that we want to find out who they are. Specifically thinking of church-based groups who may be helping more than just the membership of their own church. We just don't know about them. We want to know so we can get people where they need to go. I have mentioned this to the interagency council that as they begin their budget review process and coming forward, that we may be a little bit more detailed with what they're being asked to bring forward. If they have annual reports, please provide those with that. So begun talking to them about that. A3, initiate comprehensive review of traffic throughout the county with a particular focus on high traffic areas around the Lake Monticello community. You've begun doing that already. Last meeting, you approved the comprehensive safety action plan grant application with the TJPDC, the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, and tonight on the consent agenda you have another item requesting VDOT zone consent. That was the resolution. Well, anyway, to get the safety study on Route 600. So you've actually already doing some of those things.
Now, the one thing I would add to that is those that we put into for VDOT.
Smart scale
that did not get approved, like the intersection at Troy Road and Route 15. Yeah. I don't like, unless we have to leave it at just around Lake Monticello. There are other.
Oh yeah,
Brewerton Lake at 53. Yeah. You know that we need to have a study of all.
Yeah, intersections that are.
Right.
There are problems.
Problems.
Mm-hmm. Like problems and concerns.
Problems.
Yes.
Yeah. So that is a big concern.
We don't want anybody to think we're only looking there. Nope. We're looking around the county, and those are the ones that right now we can identify for and find grant.
Yep.
So if I change that to say initiate comprehensive review of high volume traffic areas throughout the county with a particular focus on areas around Lake Monticello, would that more closely?
I said, I just want to make sure we got.
Got it. Bring it back.
It's not just looking at that area. I mean, because the highest traffic road in Flavanna is Route 15.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Or at least it was 3 years ago.
Still is.
I figured.
A4. Okay, I will be reading off my paper.
You got Mr. Dahl's picture back up.
Very broadly, A4 is community transportation options and alternatives, and that.
All right, hold on.
Captures.
We may be. Okay, we're back. All right, I just want to make sure we're not dead on the.
That captures many different options. You talked in the retreat about shared school bus and drivers providing transportation for county residents, TJPDC, rural transportation work group, and jaunts. That just encapsulated a whole bunch. And I believe that was one of the ones that had previously independent entries of this that we brought together under one, community transportation options and alternatives.
That's what the Reverend was talking about.
And we just so happen to have John here this evening, too, to do a
little. I already looked at it.
Yeah.
A5, implement annual county volunteer recognition ceremony. I don't think we can get anything done this year. We'll work on that next year, whatever that year might be. A6, design implementation plan for professional fire chief position. In the retreat, you talked about how the review, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on what that was called. That had been done, and now it was time to actually look at that and move forward with whatever recommendations there were, or to hash out how you were going to move forward with that. So that's what that came out of. Moving on to B, communication. Develop communication plan to inform residents of county projects, accomplishments, and where the tax dollars are spent. I think you've heard me say many times, I am always looking for ways to improve communication. So that is not going to stop, and it really should have a little X in year one as well, because that's not something I'm waiting until year two. But as far as a specific instrument to get out to people, that will happen in the next year. Project management, C1, continue Columbia area renewal efforts. You certainly heard tonight that is wanted. If we had any question at all, that is a desired thing. C2, complete a master water and sewer plan phase one to identify sources for the county's long-term water needs, particularly for each of its community planning areas. I believe that's nearly complete.
It's about done pretty much when we come to the board for the final water and sewer ordinance. I think we're going to come with the finalized plan too. I mean, the Dewberry already came to present kind of the master water and sewer plan, but there's an actual document. So,
yeah. So we get to check that one off pretty soon. C3, continue the Palmyra Village streetscape. So phase one, that project will begin in 2025, which will address street flow, sidewalks, and street parking on Stone Jill Street side of Civil War Park. Phase two will bring in crosswalks, sidewalks, and parking on Main Street. And then there, you know, two below that. So the C3.1, that was a smart scale award that was granted. That's a check mark. C3.2, you had mentioned that you wanted to look for other ways to civic displays, flags or banners of some sort that really highlighted, well, really anything, residents, historically important residents or students who were graduating.
And we have that same option under Fork Union as
we
well.
We do have that same option under Fork Union. C4, successfully oversee and manage the Flavanna County aspects of the James River Water Project. It's moving right along, getting ready to enter into phase two archaeological surveying. So pretty excited about that. And that's about all I can say about it is it's moving. It's not stalled at the moment. It is actually moving. Successfully oversee and manage the design and construction of the Zion Crossroads Water and Sewer System. Eric, do you want to provide any update on that or not? Or?
We're getting close.
Okay.
Very close.
Check mark's coming soon. C6, pursue Fork Union revitalization. I think we discussed that there wasn't a lot happening with VDOT related activities, but you did mention the civic displays, flags, banners, notable residents, etc. So we threw that one in there. And of course, any of these, as we move along, can be added to. I mean, a great opportunity comes up and we just can jump on that. C7, oversee new administration building project. This is obviously a multi-year project, although there is hope that C7.1, create and issue an RFP for design, will happen before the end of this year. And then C7.2 would be the selection of the design of the firm for the design for the new administration building in the next year. So there's some actionable items there that can hopefully begin to take shape. Moving on to D, community development enrichment. D1, draft a formal countywide economic development and tourism strategy inclusive of an implementation schedule. D1.1 is adopt an economic development strategic plan, which you will hopefully do tonight. And then the D1.2 would be to implement the 5-year economic development strategic plan, which would happen after the first of the year. D2, seek opportunities to coordinate development activity at Fluvanna's northern border with Louisa County. I think that's something that continues pretty much all the time anyway, always looking for options. No specific project identified there. D3, hold an economic development discussion forum for local businesses with planning, zoning, building inspections, and infrastructure components, potentially before the end of this year. Once the Zion Crossroads water system comes online, that will be a thing that can happen pretty quickly and get folks in there to talk about that.
And, you know, we had even talked about even potentially doing some ribbon cutting or something like that. Maybe we have the tap flowing and water's just flowing out of it or something, so they know that we're ready for business. But anyway, you know, to kind of bring some attention to that, you know, get businesses out, get developers out, so they, you know, so we can ask questions and then get the information out there.
Definitely. People will believe it when they see it.
A little bit,
yes.
Of that. Maybe they'll see it when they believe it. D4, investigate options for utilizing the Dominion proffer of $500,000 for recreation and green space. That'll be an ongoing discussion until it's identified. D5, investigate opportunities to support expanded recreation opportunities, arts, and tourism. So this is another one that we combined several of the previous goals, coordination with state agencies regarding the installation of additional boat ramps along the Rivanna and James Rivers, Fridays after 5 at Pleasant Grove, those sorts of things. All kind of fell under this idea of expanded opportunities, whether it be recreation, arts, or tourism.
Real quickly, is Pleasant Grove now in Fort Union?
It's in Fort Union. Interesting. It's south of the river.
South of the river.
Yes.
The river is divided and formed between Kent Stowe and Fort Union.
That adds a lot of leeway.
Well, the proffer money is very wide open.
Yeah.
Good point. D7, implement stronger code enforcement on the county's spot blight abatement program. That's happening.
Yeah, so. we do that right now. Well, I mean, stronger, yes. I mean, to do even stronger, that's, I mean, you know, citizens are already reporting on properties that are blighted or a health hazard or a concern. You know, to do much stronger, you know, you'd have to have a dedicated full-time person to that. But the county's approach to spot blight was based upon
I hate to go back to this, I'm sorry. Just real quick, should we include PVCC possibly with the teaching farm at Pleasant Grove? Going back to what you talked about that
morning.
Interestingly, we talked about that with PVCC. The new PVCC president came by the offices yesterday, and we threw that out there. Yep. And I said, to quote, I'm pretty sure our board chair would be very dissatisfied with me if I did not at least bring this to your attention. And they were receptive. Yep. Let's see, D8, review the subdivision ordinance on cluster subdivisions, large lot subdivisions.
And I think that's really going to come before the board, really after the comp plan's done and everything. So the comp plan gets done first, and then that's kind of a second phase down the road. And that's why we have that in year two.
Did I skip D6 altogether and just not even read it
out
loud?
I'm sorry.
I circled PG Park and wrote in Fork Union and then completely skipped over the fact that I hadn't read it. Of course, I don't know what year it is either,
D8.
So what do you expect from me? D8 was the cluster subdivisions, large lot subdivisions. D9, review the zoning ordinance to look at higher density options between CPAs and R4 designations, which I think what Mr. Dahl just spoke about, the D8 probably goes for that as well.
Yep.
And finally, financial stewardship and efficiency, E1, reduce the county's reliance on creating and mailing paper checks for payments and implementation of expanded ACH EFT transaction options functioning within 30 days. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
E2, implement credit card payment option for citizens at all county funds collection points through Munis cash sharing process.
We just had a meeting between myself, Ms. Lenher, IT, finance, just to kind of look at. We had an RFP through our current provider, but we're working out some contractual issues, and if we don't get them worked out in a short manner, we're also looking at some other alternatives.
Are you talking about the checks?
No, this is for a credit card processor.
Yeah, that's what I
mean. Yeah. I mean, really, and not to get too deep in the weeds, but really, for Ms. Lenner's office, it's really finding an application that is a seamless integration within our current financial system. So they're not having to do one entry here from a credit card standpoint and then do another separate entry from the financial system standpoint. And so there's just some complications with credit card processors, contractual things, and vendors that really, other vendors that their credit card processing systems implement and just function right into this.
So maybe this is for deeper for another time, but as you know, Linda did email the entire board and you about this, and I've had conversations with her about it, and as she said, it won't have it active through the end of the year.
No. And no, for this next December, no, it won't be in place.
And I'm just a layman being on the outside of it. I think about how many municipalities must have all these things work properly already, and it just seems like it's just really going on for a long time to make this thing happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of them do the two-step process. Some of them may have the thing where they have to do the entry in there and the entry in our financial system. You know, one thing that Ms. Leniher said is, you know, one, she wants to find a system that everything's integrated. It's a one-step process. So, like I said, we just had a meeting. I think it was Monday, potentially, we met with Ms. Leniher about this. So she's reaching out to some of her counterparts. You know, for instance, you know, we have Munis Tyler Technologies for our financial system and our tax. You know, Guchlin has the same thing. Louisa Tax, they don't use Munis for their tax, but Orange County has it. I think Ms. Leniher was going to try and, one, reach out to the Orange County treasurer and see what are they using, and just kind of go visit with them and see how that works into their system. So it's a matter of trying to find the credit card processor and the localities that have the same type of financial system that we have. So. But yeah, no, it's beyond frustrating. Right. So.
And last but not least, plan for ways to adequately fund, implement, and standardize the capital improvement plan, eliminating deferred CIP projects. So those were your identified goals for the next 16 months or whatever it is. What did I miss? What did I incorrectly summarize or cobble together, or what would you like me to add?
I think we went through it as you went through. Do y'all think of anything else that needs to be added? I can't. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you.
All right. Do we have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt the Board's 2022-2023 two-year plan as presented.
Second.
Motion made by Mrs. Booker, seconded by Mrs. Eager. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Next up is E, Economic Development Strategic Plan. Ms. Schmidt.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So I'm like Ms. Harris, I can't see the screen, so I'm taking glasses off. Okay, so we're going to talk about the Economic Development Strategic Plan and go through everything kind of all over again, just a little bit for the public's information as well. The strategic plan development timeline, we started this process July 2021. The county approved a contract with Platinum PR, Sandy Dubay, to facilitate the creation of an economic development strategic plan that was put on hold with my predecessor leaving and me coming in. We picked it back up December, January, and January 2022, Platinum PR held interviews with members of the Board of Supervisors, the Economic Development Authority. In addition, we had three focus group sessions that were conducted. One group was comprised of county staff, and we had two groups of community stakeholders. These community stakeholders included businesses, residents, community organizations, educators, and industry partners. Data was collected from these meetings and was used to draft the strategic goals that I brought to you April 2022. Platinum PR presented the proposed economic development strategic goals to the board, and we received feedback. From there, we transitioned and brought to you in August 2022 at the Board of Supervisors retreat the draft economic development strategic plan. So the vision and goals reflect the data-driven objectives identified during this planning period, and we'll go over the vision now. The vision for the strategic growth, a focus on people, prosperity, and placemaking will support a vibrant economy and enhance our quality of life. People is the first one. We're going to improve employment opportunities to elevate residents and businesses. Position Fluviana County's workforce for success. For success through skills development. Develop talent attraction initiatives to grow opportunities in Fluviana County
and showcase residential real estate to attract, retain, and grow available talent. Prosperity. We're going to attract and retain industries and advance our communities. That I just heard. Retain existing industries that build upon our strengths. Attract growth-oriented sectors aligning with our economic objectives. These sectors include business and financial services, light manufacturing, transportation and logistics, agribusiness, food processing and technology, health services, forest and wood products. These were all identified in a study that was done by the Central Virginia Economic Development Partnership. We're also going to foster foster entrepreneurship within Luke Vanda County. A robust commitment to entrepreneurship will help Fluvanna keep pace with the evolving needs of businesses, residents, and the workforce. We'll improve the variety of commercial real estate options to support businesses, business attraction, retention, and expansion opportunities. Placemaking, we will enhance the spaces where people live, work, play in Fluvanna County. We'll prioritize the infrastructure to meet the needs of residents and businesses and leverage tourism assets to boost visitor appeal. And so out of this, we also created four strategic goals that have been identified to shape the economic growth and community prosperity in Fluvanna County. The first goal is to position Fluvanna County as a business-friendly county with competitive assets in the Central Virginia region. We're going to do that by reorganizing and communicating steps of streamlined and standardized business permitting process to new and existing businesses in Fluvanna County. I'm having a terrible time reading this, y'all. It's like really tired.
Yeah, poor light there.
Design potential business incentive offerings in Fluvanna County. We're going to promote the Fluvanna County Shovel Ready Sites program to landowners, businesses, and the community at large to encourage the creation of higher tiered pad ready sites in Fluvanna County. And we're going to continue to promote and invest in key growth areas in Fluvanna County, including but not limited to the Fork Union area, Columbia, Palmyra, and Zion's Crossroads area. Goal two, we're going to foster entrepreneurship, business growth, and expansion in Fluvanna County through business retention efforts. We're going to continue to collaborate at the regional level to provide programs and services, share resources and assets to reduce the costs and improve quality. We're going to formalize a county business retention expansion program. Again, that's one that we're actually already doing, but we're going to get it on paper. We're going to create a business database of existing businesses for tracking business metrics in Fluvanna County. We did strike the all businesses as per your request at the retreat. We're going to support and advocate and promote the new community commercial kitchen that is underway. We have got some dual permitting we're going to do between the Virginia Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. We're going to explore entrepreneurial support opportunities such as the development of a co-working space, business incubator, or makerspace. We're going to work towards the creation of a new position geared towards marketing and tourism promotion and business retention within the Fluvanna County Economic Development Office. We're going to develop a comprehensive hazard mitigation plan for businesses within Fluvanna County. On to goal three, we're going to develop new and enhance existing tourism experiences, activities, and events in Fluvanna County to increase tourism attraction. We're going to do this by devising and implementing a Shop Local Incentives program. That has actually already been started too. Brian actually started the From Fluvanna. We also have an online business database as well. We're going to
promote local experiences in agritourism, viticulture, artisans, events, parks, and outdoor recreation. And we're going to also research and apply for grants to support tourism initiatives in Louisiana County. Lastly, our goal four. We're going to support Louisiana County businesses with talent retention and retention challenges. We're going to establish partnerships with local educational institutions and workforce partners to develop a talent pipeline to fit local skills needs. We're going to advocate for the Louisiana County business community as the community addresses its infrastructure challenges. In addition to all of that, we did include a final portion to the plan that's new to you. To assist in achieving these goals, we plan to leverage our relationships with these particular partners. So we have Central Virginia Partnership for Economic Development, Central Virginia Small Business Development Center, the Community Investment Collaborative, the Fluvanna Chamber of Commerce, the Fluvanna County Economic Development and Tourism Advisory Committee, Fluvanna County Economic Development Authority, Fluvanna County Public Schools, Fork Union Military Academy, Piedmont Virginia Community College, Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, Virginia Career Works, Virginia Cooperative Extension, Virginia Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, also known as VDACs, and VDP, which is the Virginia Economic Development Partnership. There, I'm going to open it for questions. That's a lot to go over again.
I would like you to go back to number three. Promote the local experiences. I think I asked this question before. We have artisans, but we do not address the performing and visual arts, which is this building right here. This is a great economic driver. Whenever we can get back into, that's why I'm so adamant about us getting out of this building, so that we can do those kinds of things. There's some art on the wall back there. But artisan is different from the arts of performing and visual arts. And I think it definitely should be recognized because we have an arts center here in Fluvanna County with this nice auditorium. I think they just put up a brand new huge screen. A new screen today.
Yeah, they do.
And they're doing some other work.
That's going to be the projector.
Yeah.
This place has so many qualities that we can bring in plays and all kinds of things, and people can get out in the community and spend their money, and it's an economic drive. But we've got to get out of this building to let these people do their work.
Anyone else?
I've got a few things, but first I want to mention, can we not set up some sort of like little pedestal light on this thing or something? Because I noticed this with different people. And again, and I was kidding earlier, but seriously, going from there to here is a major light difference.
Going from where Miss Booker is to here.
It's a struggle.
and I can just imagine there. I mean, there's no light to see what you have. I was just wondering if we can get something that clips onto the end.
We can. And we noticed, too, that there was something weird with the lighting settings here because it's lighter in that back corner where it's darker in that corner. So the normal settings that we normally have,
it's light on.
I know, like I said, so... Some challenges that we found as we came in here today, and we're not as familiar with all the, I mean, there's a giant light board up there that we had it set set a certain way, but yeah, we can look at that.
Thank you. It is a struggle.
Yeah, we knew you could read.
All right.
Well, I have some things. So one, the mission statement will of course change now that we've changed our mission statement, correct?
Yes.
So that'll be updated in there. Two, I've got real concern with number three, showcase residential real estate and to attract, retain, and grow available talent.
Which one is that?
Number three, under people. When I first read last year the term, that the county had used the term workforce housing, on building and attract workforce housing, you know, I used to be chair of the Economic Development Commission, and our charge was to get business to subsidize the burden on the rooftops. And that's what we always hear in Flugana, is get more businesses to take some of the pressure off the residences. But then we talk about bringing in more residences to so we can get more businesses. And then once we have more residences, then we need more businesses to take the pressure off of the residences. And it just, you know, people need business. Business need people. People need business. And we just keep becoming what everybody's trying not to become. And so I'm not one to say let's attract and try to bring people, more people to live into Savannah County. And TJPDC, you know, it quotes them and in this section. And much of what TJPDC is about is, it says it in their first paragraph of their housing plan, the last sentence in it, talks about something to the effect of us having, all the municipalities taking on all types of residential growth, so one municipality doesn't bear all the burden. In other words, they're saying, so the Charlottesville area doesn't bear all the burden, they call it themselves, burden of that type of housing that they're trying to get us to accept and take on here. And so I don't, and it will come up for me in the comprehensive plan discussions, I don't buy into that we need to bring more people to create this prosperity, and especially when it's being directed to us by TJPDC. And I don't mean that as an overarching statement about TJPDC, there's plenty of good they do. I just disagree with them about plenty within the housing piece. And so when this is an economic plan and we're saying bring in more people that will create more burden, I just don't think it should be there.
I would like to bring in more people to Park Union.
Yeah, the only thing about that,
you know, you have to look at the different areas. I mean, we have developments that haven't been developed because we can't get people there. We don't have a grocery store because there are not enough people. They use the stores that we've had as convenience stores. I run in here and get my six-pack of beer when I need it, or tomatoes and so forth. So I do want some growth in Park Union.
I'm sorry, Moselle, I didn't interrupt. She's actually passing the plate.
So how do you fan out? When you're talking, are you talking about strictly the northern part of the county? Or are you talking about the entire county?
I'm talking entire, because, and you and I have had this conversation recently, and I understand that one, mm-hmm. and I hear it a lot from people in the Fort Union area. Yeah. But when you bring in more residential growth so you can get those stores, now all those people will pay more taxes.
And I think the county needs to do a study on this, because I think it is something that is a common sort of fallacy out there. If this was the case, then Albemarle County would be stone broke, right? Mm-hmm. Because they have more residences and people than we have. Not every county falls into a trap where residents inevitably result in more costs. Okay, that is not a true statement across the board. You can do the math and you can look at the type of resident. You can look at how many services, the amount of the wages that they earn, the type of household that's there. All of those things determine whether or not one individual or one household individual adds a burden in the course of the time of that student's lifetime within the county. It's this idea that we can close our doors and not have any further growth in terms of housing in Flugana County is frankly a little bit absurd. Right. I mean, there are people that want to move to this county. There are landowners that own land here that want to sell and develop their property. There are people that would like to have their kids living next door to them. we can't control the growth. In fact, Louisiana County over the last decade has had one of the slowest growth periods in the last 50 years at 1.6%. And the decade before that was equally pretty slow at about 4%. So it's not as if we're exploding out of control.
Actually, that's not true. That's true. The decade before that,
a decade before that was also around 4.6%. Maybe it's 6%, but it's pretty low between the two decades. The decade before that, it was 23%. So that's when it was very high at that point in time. But, you know, we as a county have to look into the needs of the residents. And in terms of workforce development, well, I'm on the Go Virginia board. That's a conversation that's being had at the Richmond level and saying, we don't have enough affordable housing. And we say affordable, it doesn't mean Section 8. Doesn't mean, it's just the balance of the types of houses that are available in that area in order to attract people to live in a particular area where those jobs are they're gonna be, right? That's basically what you're trying to do when you create this balance between housing, jobs, retail, opportunity, schools, core services, right? You're trying to create that balance. When you have periods of high level of growth, such as when we had that, you know, 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago, during that period of time, yes, it's hard to adjust and adapt to that. But if we hadn't built a new high school, our tax rate would still be very low, right? Because that's one of the big burdens on it. But we had to build a new high school, right? We had to build a new high school in part because it was a really old high school before that. It'd been around for 50 years, you know? But I just think this idea of simply saying that, you know, Flavanna County must maintain its rural nature no matter what, okay? It shouldn't have any growth. It shouldn't allow any new development is not what Flavanna County is. That, to me, is not what it is. Part of what makes Flavanna County great and brilliant is the fact that we have people that come from all kinds of different places, is the fact that we respect the areas that we grow. It's the fact that we have diversity in the form of Lake Monticello, in the form of Kent Store, in the form of Fork Union, in the form of Columbia. We have that diversity. It is a very big and growing county. We've invested millions of dollars to try to bring economic development into the area. And there has to be a balance between the two, of economic development and growth. Now, I don't think it's anybody's intention on this board to take the limited amount of water that's coming from ZXR and allocate it towards housing. So we have, within the comprehensive plan, we have regulations that say, here's the amount of growth that can happen. And we're limiting it from that standpoint. You know, but these kinds of conversations shouldn't be in economic development plans.
I agree.
I don't. I think that.
Well, I thought you just said they shouldn't be.
They should not be, right?
You said they should not be in this conversation.
The idea that we are going to say housing growth is part of our economic development plan is separate. That's part of the comprehensive plan again. How we grow is part of a comprehensive plan. Our economic
development. I'm not going to interrupt. I'm trying to clarify what you're saying. Are you saying it should not be a part of this conversation?
I'm saying that specifically saying that we shouldn't have, okay, because you're saying we want to highlight and attract the type of living opportunities that are in the county. You object to that, right? You say, I don't want to highlight the fact that we're a good place to live.
As a part of economic development.
As a part of economic development.
Right.
Right? But people that want to move into this area, they want to know what kind of county it is. They want to know what kind of homes are available. They want to know if it's a good place to live. They want to know if there's good schools there, right? So we should be highlighting that, right? That's part of the economic package that we offer as a county. We have good schools. We have great parks. We have great police and sheriff's office. We have responsive fire and core services. We have a diversity of neighborhoods. We have a diversity of housing available. Those should be the things that are part of our economic development package. But not saying, hey, let's not highlight what's great about Flavanna, and let's not talk about growing Flavanna, because, you know, we don't want growth. I mean, that in itself puts a stop to economic development, in my opinion. You know, the minute you go out and say to an employer, we're not going to change, we're not going to grow, chances are they're not going to come here. You know, that's my opinion.
So I was talking about, I didn't say anything about restricting. I said about asking, attracting. It says, you know, about attracting that type of growth. And so I didn't say stop growth in any way, nor did I even suggest it. What I said was to ask for what I see as the adverse to what we're, the reason we're trying to get economic development. It's simple numbers to me. And we, as a county, just everybody's aware of Colonial Circle and the 124 apartments that are going in there that are government subsidized. So to say that's not the type of stuff we mean, while it's Fluvanna's first government subsidized housing and done all in part, the conversations that happened at this board and throughout government was about workforce housing. And the citizens are saying, plenty of citizens are saying, I'm uncomfortable with that. And so we're bringing on this workforce housing that's going to create a substantially greater financial burden. And it is true. And I agree. Let's get the numbers. We'll just disagree, but on whether it's true or not, that rooftops bring more financial burden on a municipality. But pretty much everybody I've talked to in government agrees with that, including our former commissioner of the revenue. That first I ever heard it was when he stood up in front of the board of supervisors, and Mr. Loving said it to the board of supervisors, and he gave an exact number. Here's the burden that this creates with every new household.
So answer this anecdotally: how come some of the largest counties with the largest populations are some of the most successful counties? How does that correlate?
How do you define success? I'm just saying
that if you look at it and you say automatically that a house is a burden, so therefore counties shouldn't have houses, right? Because they'll fail.
But I didn't say that.
That's something that is part of
it. I didn't say the county shouldn't have houses. I said we shouldn't be as a part of an economic plan that's created to relieve the burden of houses, also say let's bring more houses. And so how you define their prosperity, you've said it before, look at all the different taxes that Albemarle and other counties pay in addition to just property tax. So I don't want to become Albemarle. If that's prosperity, that's not for me. And when it costs us more to get there, then I don't see the benefit. And so I don't want to encourage that being in our plan.
To me, when I read that statement that you're talking about, I don't think it's saying build more houses.
Are you talking about the last
showcase residential real estate? And I think that's the one you're talking about, Mr. Fairchild.
Or are you talking about something specific?
Showcase residential real estate to attract, retain, and grow available talent.
To attract and grow talent.
Okay, Chris, hang on. Oh, yeah. I'm talking. I've been quiet, but let me say what I wanted
agree.
To say.
It's a conversation.
Can I say what I wanted to say before you interrupt?
Well, then thank you. Then give me the go when you're done.
I will.
Okay.
Trying to be civil. To me, all it says is it's trying to attract people that are, I'm trying to figure out the best way to put this, upper level jobs, not building new houses, just to showcase the houses that we have already. That's when I read that and see. Okay? Go ahead.
It is. First of all, I want to say we all in conversations have times where we don't wait until a person finishes a sentence. It's conversation, and it's not always interrupting. It's conversational. Right. We all do it, and so we got to be careful about each time we use that, because then we end up doing it to somebody else. When it says attract and grow, that's people. When it says available talent, talent is people. That says attract and grow people.
Okay, we have people that leave every day. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I look at it. Now, people can look at it and see it any way they want. And for the most part, three of us have sat here and listened to two of y'all have this conversation, and we've been very respectful. That's the first time I went to say something. And before I said anything, I was cut off.
I
disagree. That's the first time I went to say something.
Right.
And so I think you just said exactly what I was trying to say. Retain or attract talent. High-paying jobs, things of that nature. People that are going to fill high-paying jobs. And like I said, I'm not a big fan of building houses everywhere either. People know that. Yep, I was a deciding vote on the Colonial Circle subdivision. Because I've looked at that as a place where our kids that we're losing, they graduate from high school and have no place to live when they first get out, except at home, as a place for them to have an apartment, things of that nature. So we keep and retain the talent that we produce.
So. I was walking to the football game the other day, and on Alderman, walking down Alderman towards the stadium there was a 1,300 square foot home. I venture to guess, if you guys can figure out what that house was being sold for. 1,300 square foot home built in the 1950s.
$780,000.
Yeah. So the challenge is that, Charlottesville has become so expensive that people can't live in Charlottesville any longer. And they push that out to the surrounding counties. And if the surrounding counties don't have inventory, then they become expensive and then they get pushed out even further. And so then, to Mr. Sheridan's point, you have maybe your son who wants to live here, maybe my daughter, maybe your daughter and son who want to live here, but they can't afford to buy a starter home. They can't even come up with the down payment for it because it's $150,000 to do that. So having housing that addresses the opportunity for somebody to live in the area, and in some cases you can define that as subsidized. In this case, it was 60 or 70% of AMI, which is pretty high up there since we have a pretty high AMI to begin with, of $66,000, $68,000, I think. That was a need. Most studies now show that when you take subsidized housing and you incorporate and you mix it with regular housing, you get a better outcome than when you concentrate subsidized housing all in one area. I think Colonial Circle is going to be a great success. Pinnacle Group does a really good job. I don't think we should be afraid of embracing different types of housing needs. I think we have to look at it and say, if we expect workforce development, if the governor, who wants to add 500,000 new jobs, that's people, sets that as a mandate for, the state of Virginia in terms of its growth goals, then we have to expect that out of that 500,000 people, we might get 3,000 or 2,000 or maybe only 500 people that move to Flavanna County. But they'll be part of what comes into Flavanna County. Again, I think that if you look at, Go Virginia, you look at economic development, and you can tell me I'm wrong if you like, that the correlation between housing and jobs is a very tight correlation. The availability and affordability of housing is a very tight correlation in terms of attracting employers, because they need to know that if they're only paying $22 an hour, their employees are going to be able to live in that particular area. If that's their model, their business model, that's what they have to figure out and do. So it's important that we have housing that matches up with the economic goals that we have, and I think that's an important statement. That's all I have to say about it.
And my one last question would be, so all you're saying is, and we've spent a long time discussing this, you don't think this is the place that this belongs? Is that what both of y'all said?
No, I think it does belong there.
In economic development. Because I don't think this one's talking about housing.
It's people. I'm not talking about houses. And when you attract more people, it means you need more houses. And the word talent is a replacement for people. And attract and grow available people.
Is that what that means?
It can mean, the way I read it, too.
Would you interpret that, please?
The way I would interpret it is retain and grow. So that could be growing our young youth, right, here in Flavanna, or bringing them back after college.
Right.
But then attract, to your point, yes, I mean, we will be attracting the jobs for some high manufacturing type company.
But I look at it this way too. I mean, again, if we are attracting, we have people that are in this community that are retiring or maybe that they want to downsize from the community and the houses that they're in. One, we have existing great residential real estate, and we want to attract people to come here. That if someone moves out, we want this to be a great place for people to be able to live and work in this community. And so that's, again, under this topic, it talks about people, and it says improve employment opportunities to elevate residents and businesses. Mm-hmm. So there may be a component of attraction and growth, but I don't think that's I don't think that's the whole driver of this necessarily, or the meaning behind it.
Well, I just mentioned also in the housing, they quote a study from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and then the same paragraph talks about 11,047 housing units. The paragraph itself acknowledges that attracting talent equates to housing. That's the paragraph that's in this. So we can discuss. I just say, Mike, when you say you don't necessarily think of that as housing, this says attracting, you know, people in the effect of housing.
You're saying 11,000 new dwellings here?
I'm saying 2018 evaluation of 11,047 housing units in Flavanna County revealed the following. And I'm saying this section discusses when attracting those people, what that means to housing. So it says in itself that is the people equate to housing.
Yeah, I think we should move on, but I mean, honestly, if there is not a clear understanding between the correlation of workforce, housing, and jobs, then I think in my opinion, we won't see the type of growth either economically, and we won't attract the type of businesses that ultimately help to relieve the burden. The fact of the matter is that we can have one business that can substantially change, you know, our tax burden and base. But the question is, how do you come in and attract that one business? What are their needs? What are they going to do? You know, in Fork Union, as Mrs. Booker pointed out, and in Columbia, perhaps there's lots of people that would like to find higher paying jobs that they can't afford to do, that where they don't have to commute into Richmond and back and forth. We as a county need to be forward thinking, and housing is part of that being forward thinking. It doesn't automatically mean that we open the doors to 10,000 new people coming to Flavanna County. It does mean that in the relationship between our economic objectives, that we keep in mind what our housing inventory and what our housing costs are and how they correlate in terms of the economic jobs that are coming into the area.
I think that I am for affordable housing, but at the same time, I think what happened when we voted on Colonial Circle, the fact that it was a $500 million company and they won't be paying taxes for 10 years, and then they'll only be paying partial taxes, I didn't think that was fair to the other people who are already here living in their homes and paying taxes.
You know, that's a decision the board took. It's already been taken. We also turned down another housing apartment development where they asked for no tax relief, and we just turned it down. So, you know,
that makes sense.
I mean, at the time, that was the only people that offered. Since I've been on the board, I don't know, Mrs. Booker's been on the board longer. I don't know how many times an apartment building has come up as an option for Flavanna County.
But we do have a lot of homes that are affordable.
I mean, maybe, I don't know, you know.
But statistically, Flavanna does not have an affordable housing issue. That's, I mean.
No, but rent prices have increased dramatically. That is the case. Housing prices have increased, 25% in the last year and have continued to grow. Granted, they fell back and we need to happen and catch back up. I'm not saying that's not the case. But again, anecdotally, if you look at the fact that townhomes are being sold for $500,000 on Pantops Mountain, that's just a townhome, you're going to see that expansion of the housing costs going up. And part of that boils down to the fact that, counties and boards like ours, I don't want to say artificially restrict growth, they try to control the growth, but depending on the needs and the conversations that are having in those counties, you can come up with shortages. And right now, there was an article that I think was in Forbes that basically said, housing prices are starting to come down, rents are still going up, and that's probably not going to change. And the reason is because there is about a 6 million home shortfall in the United States right now. and we haven't kept up with kind of just the general demand of housing, and so you're going to continue to see these kinds of ebbs and flows. And you know, in our area in Central Virginia, housing is going to be, you know, expensive, and that's not necessarily, you know, the end of the world, but it you know, it also depends on the kinds of jobs that you're trying to bring into the area. So I just think it's an important part of the conversation as an economic development part, and I don't think we should be.
Going back to the plan, is there something that we want pulled or stricken, or, I mean, right now we're just focusing on a plan, and we're supposed to be like 10 minutes, and we've been about 30 now, I think. And the poor guys back there from John are sitting there patiently waiting. I'm not trying to say that it needs us to rush to it, but let's go back to what we're looking at.
Well, and I believe this is very important. And
that being said, I agree.
And I'm not going to say I'm talking, but I was in a sentence. So I see, Mike, that's what we got to be careful about, because we can end up doing that.
I just want us to focus and move forward.
I hear you. So I feel that number three should be wiped from the plan. I think it's misplaced to be a part of the economic development strategic plan.
I disagree. Take a nod of heads if you like. From there.
Who agrees? Who disagrees?
I disagree.
Ms. Eager, you said you were for affordable housing or whatever, but do you want it stricken or?
This is not.
No, it's not about affordable housing.
It's fine.
It's not affordable.
Okay, well, you got three fines. Okay, that's why I said just, and I'm not cutting it short. This is a conversation we have at another time, but I'm just trying to move forward.
Yep.
All righty, do we have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt the FY 2023 FY 2028 Economic Development Strategic Plan as presented.
Second.
We have a motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-1 with Mr. Fairchild being the only one the nay. F, VDOT safety study on South Boston Road.
Again, I'll be quick. We talked about this a little earlier. Again, let me just go to the map. We know what we're talking about.
Yes.
Here's the intersection. Here's Broken Island Road. Here's Lake Monticello Road. What we're requesting is for VDOT to do a safety study along this stretch from basically, and we added some additional language in the resolution, and I'll show you that really quick. But again, taking it from here, going all the way to here, and you know, it's going to take a little while, and VDOT will determine what are some improvements that need to be there, whether it's signage, whether it's some clearing, or other things like that, or speed.
What would it take to add in Crofton? I mean, the others have all been looked at.
Well, I mean,
I don't know if Crofton's ever been looked at. I'm telling you, I pull out of that thing and take a left turn twice a day, and it scares the living bejesus out of me.
You know what we can do is, I mean, I could
come back later. Check with them.
Yeah, I mean, this is more.
I don't want to booger up the process.
Really, what they said is, they said if there's a particular intersection you're really kind of looking at, take that and maybe go a half mile either way. And so this really takes it kind of a half mile either way. You know, if we want to do a safety study or speed study at another location, we could certainly do that as well.
How long does it usually take them to do this?
It's probably, if I had to guess, I'm trying to think of some other things. I mean, I would imagine probably 4 months, 2 to 4 months is probably closer to 4 months is my guess.
Wow.
They did one a couple of years ago, right?
Here?
Yeah.
They did. So
I mean, they've supposedly done some sort of traffic study around
that. They've looked at some stuff, but speaking to Scott Thornton, the VDOT representative, he says he doesn't show that a safety study was done on the stretch here.
All right, and then the only other comment I would have, should you not go a little bit further down on the straightaway where you're going, coming into Broken Island there, because that's...
If the board thinks we go, I don't know, maybe up
to... I'm just saying, just because that's, if you stop right there, you know, I mean, it just seems like you have
most people are stopping at that point.
You got to take the study a little bit further.
Yeah, we could do that. We could maybe take it up to where the new proposed entrance is for the other building that's being built.
Yeah.
If the board's fine with that, we can tweak the language. That's just kind of administrative on our part. So looking at the resolution,
That other building that's being built is on top of the hill will have good line of sight in both directions.
So the only thing we change in the resolution is just the second whereas the Board of Supervisors feels there is a need for an appropriate safety study on Route 600 South Boston Road from before the intersection of Route 1040 Broken Island Road, traveling north along Route 600 South Boston Road to the intersection at Route 618 Lake Monticello Road, as the current intersection of River Ridge Drive and Riverside Gate is hazardous and needs to be evaluated for any safety and speed concerns. So that's kind of what we added to the resolution. And you know, I know we had a resident out here speaking. I wouldn't be doing my part if I didn't say I did receive an email regarding a differing opinion too, basically saying that there were some residents that lived in that side that didn't feel that intersection was an issue. And I think some people, you know, some people's thoughts were, you know, they don't have any issues coming out of there. So again, I just wanted to at least bring up that I did get some comments from a differing perspective.
Yeah, I think the challenge is, you know, something like that. If I always took a right-hand turn out of Riverside Gate, I might not be as concerned about it, right? Because I have time and I'm, you know, they're behind me. But if I'm taking a left, then it's a little bit more of a concern. And if I'm coming out the other way and I'm taking a right, then maybe it's taking a left there, then maybe it's a little bit more of a concern too. So as we know, those left-hand turns are the deadly ones.
All opinion, and the right-hand ones are almost become deadly at least twice. I've been passed by one coming from Tractor Supply. And the other day I pulled out taking a right, and the person pulling out of Riverside decided they wanted to get in front of the bus. So they took a left.
That's just absolutely.
And went down to turn lane to pass me.
That's crazy. So dangerous. So dangerous.
No idea what thought process was in their mind.
Do we make the motion?
Motion.
Please.
I move the Board of Supervisors adopt a resolution requesting a safety study of Route 600 South Boston Road in the Palmyra District around and beyond the intersection of River Ridge Drive and the Riverside Gate of Lake Monticello.
Second.
Was that you, Ms. Seeger?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Seeger. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. No appointments. And finally, is it Reich? Joint presentation, Mr. Ted Reich.
Thank you for your time. Yes, my name is Ted Reek. I really appreciate you letting me be here today. I want to recognize Hal Morgan on our board. He's been here on our board for quite a while, and a big supporter of transit in Blue Valley. Am I controlling this, or
I am? Just let me know when
the next slide. Basically, John's mission is to give people independence, allow them to live their own lives on their own terms with dignity. Not everybody is able to afford to have a car or operate a car or should drive a car, and we give them an option. And thanks to your funding of that service, you're providing independence to a number of people. Next slide. And over the years since 1975, when John began, we've accumulated quite a bit of experience in this particular area. When you look at our workforce, our drivers especially, we have over 546 years of experience. We operate in seven jurisdictions throughout the area, have over about 113 employees as well to providing these services in both urban and rural settings. Next slide. Last year was just ended June 30. People use John for basically two reasons, to make money or to spend money. We served quite a few employment trips. About 48% of the people who wrote last year were going to work of some kind, and the other 10% or 16% were involved in shopping, so economic stimulus. And that's pretty good. We only operate service within the county 3 days a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And then we provide a link service from Fluvanna to Albemarle, Charlottesville twice a week. I think there's room for more service, but we will visit that at a different time. Next. Again, we give people an opportunity to live independently. If you have older people, I have an older mom. They want to live independently. They don't want to depend upon their kids to go to appointments or shopping. They want to live it on their own terms. And the caregivers would like to give independence to their parents, but also they have lives themselves. And being able to have John solves two issues. It helps the caregivers and helps the person being cared for. Next slide. I think we also promote healthy outcomes by providing access to medical services. People can get preventative care. If they don't have that access, they may wait until it's late and have to call an EMT in order to meet a medical need. We hopefully prevent some of that, and again, provide a much higher quality of life, again, because of the investment that the county is making. Next slide. We also give an opportunity for people to live in a more dignified way. There are studies that say that if you spend more than 50% of your income on housing and transportation, you're in a difficult situation. There are quite a few people who have to make a choice between keeping a car on the road so they can go to work, or buying groceries, or buying shoes for the kids, or going to the doctor. There is a margin of people that are living on the edge. With John, we're able to reduce that transportation cost and give people an opportunity to live a better life than they might otherwise be able to live. Next slide. And finally, I think it's a good investment, not only in getting people out and about in the community. I think the gentleman from Columbia mentioned the need to get people out of that community. The investment in transit really turns over seven times. For every dollar invested in transit, that dollar gets spent seven times. So if you spend $40,000 on transit, that's like spending $280,000. In the case of Fluvanna, your investment in transit for the amount of money that Fluvanna puts in, we're able to provide three times the level of service because we're able to leverage federal and state grants to match that. Next one. We're not resting, though, on our current situation. We want to get better and improve ourselves. The first thing is, next slide, is we're looking at alternatively fueled vehicles. A lot of discussion about greenhouse gases and climate change. We're trying to not contribute to that. We want to reduce greenhouse emissions that our services produce by 45% by 2030. So we're looking at hydrogen fuel vehicles, fuel cells, electric vehicles, as well as compressed natural gas. We're studying each of those alternatives, see which ones make the most sense for John and provides the best return on our investment. Next slide. Also, people's travel needs are changing. You've all heard of Uber. The way you use John today is you need to make a reservation, usually a day or two in advance. What we want to do is provide spontaneous travel so that the same day you want to go somewhere, you can book a trip, hopefully on your mobile phone or call in, and we can provide a trip right away. We're looking at providing that type of a service throughout our service area, and hopefully someday that'll be applied to to Fluvanna. Next slide. We're also doing a five-year transit plan, trying to determine the needs of the county, both now and in the future. We are beginning to study the people who use transit most, where do they live, where do they want to go. This map kind of aggregates a number of factors. The darker the blue, the more need there is for transit, the more market there is. And you can see in Fluvanna, quite a few areas have a high need for transit relative to other areas. Next slide. Focusing on older people, again, the darker the green, the higher the population of older people. These are just some of the factors that we're looking at as far as our new plan. Next slide. And we want to promote our services. We're trying to recover from COVID, and we're running some commercials. And yeah. Caitlin, can we play that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm
going to okay.
Play. I think I have it teed up here. Oops, hold on, sir. Oops, volume.
I like those glasses.
Yeah, it must be the codec.
Sure.
Sometimes in Zoom, you got to click play audio. There's a feature.
Do you...
Are you right click
on the screen? Go ahead and sing, Mr. Reed. You can do the song.
Huh?
You can do the song.
I can do a song? You don't want to hear me sing.
Hopefully it'll be better than my neighbor when I sing Cutting the Grass.
Is it just music or is it words?
There should be music. I think we're just having an audio trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I know when we played it previously just on the PC without everything else.
It's really great stuff. Mm-hmm. If you heard it, you'd just be crying in the audience there. So.
Can we send the board the link to this?
I can.
In an email?
Forward the email.
Let's do that. We'll forward the email to you with this link so you can...
Right, the link. The file's too big to actually email it, so... Anyway, we have three versions of that commercial. It kind of highlights what we do, how long we've been doing it. And we're running it on ABC, CBS, and Fox affiliates locally through the spring of 2023. So you may be able to see that when you're watching TV. And the next slide. Might be the PDF there. There you go. That's all I have. Questions?
Any questions?
Do you have any kind of price point for that microtransit that you're looking at? Or?
You mean in terms of what would my charge a rider or something? Yeah, I just don't have that information. Mm-hmm. Currently, John is fare free, though I think for this type of service, we may have to charge something, a couple of dollars. It would be heavily subsidized. Mm-hmm. I mean, to take Uber anywhere is probably a $10, $12, $15 trip. So we couldn't like, charge that to people. So the end user might pay only a few dollars of that. But we have to study that and figure that out. If we want to deploy something in Fluvanna, it would be through a public process to get people's feedback and things of that nature.
Your service, does I had a constituent who asked for help. And he needed to go to his physician up on Pandops. And they said that they would pick him up like on his way to work, so make your appointment around 10. So he would have to get on John early in the morning. And then they wouldn't pick him up and bring him home until the end of the workday. So you can't do that to a person with, you know, on a walker. They're supposed to do sit up at
the
tariff all day?
Well, we have very limited service. Like I mentioned, we're only providing service in the county 3 days a week.
Uh-huh.
And the county to city service is only 2 days a week. And we only provide a trip in the morning and a trip coming back in the afternoon.
Right.
There's nothing in between. So
so it's really not viable for an older person?
For that particular purpose, maybe not. And hopefully that should have been explained to him before he made that commitment. But if there's a need, as our planning process progresses and there seems to be a need for more service, we can certainly bring it to the administration, see if there's room in the budget to do more. But that's probably the best solution is we're providing very bare bones service right now.
Yeah. Like a midday run would be good for people like that.
Yes.
And then the microtransit, I mean, I know we're maybe a little early on some of that conversation, but like for that one, I mean, that sounds like that would be something that would be ideal for the situation that Mrs. Eager's talking about. Now, would that be, you're talking maybe it would be a couple dollars. Are you talking a couple dollars locally within Fluvanna, or if someone had to take a trip from Fluvanna to Charlottesville?
Well, it probably would be more to go that distance. And that would be the user's cost. The actual cost would be more than that.
Yeah.
They're looking at a pilot study in the Pantops area and the Holly Mead area. And I think they're predicting costs in the beginning around, I would say, $40, $50 a rider. And now the user's not going to pay that. It's going to be subsidized by the state. But it's an expensive service. So we're trying to balance that with more efficient means of providing things. So, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you for waiting patiently.
Yeah.
All righty.
Thank you to our representative, too.
Yes. Next up is H, 2022 Blue Banner County Fair Review, Mr. Stitcher.
Tony, how y'all doing this evening?
Good.
That's better. I don't know if you can hear me. All right. So I'm just here to give a brief, like an overview of what kind of happened at the fair this year. The theme today may be help needed. I'm not going to lie to you. So this county, this year at the county fair, we did 7,148 pay-in guests. So our numbers would have been more, but I had to take staff from our gates on Friday night at 7 o'clock and Saturday night at 8 o'clock because we didn't have enough staff to work the parking area of the carnival. My main job is to get people off 53 and get them into the park. And if I don't have staff, I didn't have enough staff to be able to do that and take money at the gate on those nights. So we would have, we probably had more than 8,000 visitors. If you think about the money that we weren't able to collect, that's how we tell how many people come in. Plus, on Wednesday night, we don't take money. It's just the carnival only. So we, you know, we had some people there that night. And then Thursday, it is 17 and under are free for that night. So we did not take money for those nights.
It's a pep rally night.
It's the pep rally night, yep. And then we didn't have as many of attractions for, like, bigger attractions those nights. So any questions about our attendance?
Then you have a time for special needs kids.
We did. That would be a little later on. But we did it Friday.
You do have.
Yep. It was, it's on Fridays from 10 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had about 50 this
That's
year
nice.
Come from the schools. And there are a couple older nursing home groups that came
That's
out this
great.
Year,
That's
if I'm not mistaken.
Really.
So we get a little bit of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see the parking lot does not justify what we had to park. Where if you go to the park, you see where we normally mow. We were down 3 telephone poles from the entrance of the park. So that is bush hogging down 53. The issue with that is people have a long way to walk to get to our main gate and then get back to their cars. So we are looking at a way to maybe park cars on the other side of the road next year. We're closer to the school and maybe we could use the school as an exit as long as our exit for better flow of traffic. Sorry. Next slide. So I'm going to go over the Parks and Recs expenses and revenues as well as the fair boards. So you can read advertising, general supplies, contract services. It was $16,533.81. It would have been a little bit more, but we got a donation from Food Line. The Parks and Rec, we usually don't take in donations, sponsorships. We let the fair board do that. That is how they are able to pay for a lot of their services they provide. But we had to do it this year because Food Line needed information for tax purposes, and the fair board couldn't give them what they needed. Well, the fair board's almost there to be able to give them the information. They weren't quite there. So we took that and used that to pay for the bounce houses. So it's usually going to be more than $1,000 we would spend. But with that, that's kind of how we came to that number. And these are, I think, Parks and Rec. These are the what?
Revenues.
Revenues? I'm a page off. Yep. Sorry. These are our Parks and Rec revenues. So our gate sales were up, I think, about $5,000 from last year, as well as the carnival sales rides. The carnival sales rides has to do with they were $20 this year instead of $15, but that had to do with gas prices, diesel prices for the vendor to be able to ride, provide the service. So our revenue was $35,333.50. We'll go over a little bit of the fair board's expenses and revenues. So this kind of shows you everything that the fair board is in charge of putting on for the event. They do all the entertainment. They pay for the ginger jive, the beer garden, the rodeo, the burial train, and the petting zoos. We did get parking help for one night. It was through the Boy Scouts. We couldn't find anybody else to help us. So unfortunately, me, my staff, and the fair board were in the parking lot parking cars. When that happens, we aren't able to provide the service we need to with some of the events that are going on. So we have to leave it to the people that are actually doing the event to run the event, and we're not able to help them, which really puts us in a bind. So their total expenses was $32,866.09. As I mentioned before, they get their revenues from sponsors. You can see all the sponsors there on the right. Our biggest sponsor was A&P Construction and S&N Communications. They gave $12,500 apiece. So that really helped the Fair Board get a good chunk of money to be able to move from one year to another without wondering how they're going to pay for stuff. Because, knock on some wood, we are a rainy day away from being wiped out of like $15,000 in a day if it would rain on a Saturday. So that's a way for them to be able to have some in the bank. They get a dollar from every gate sales, so that's how we came up with the 7,148 people that came into the park. And some other activities they held were Cornhole Tournament, Excavator Challenge, Power Wheels Derby, Virginia Giant was a big success, and the Rodeo. Their revenue was $74,818. So the Rodeo we're having an issue with. We don't have enough seating in our Rodeo. They were seven, I was told, I never made it down the Rodeo this year. I was told they were seven rows deep at the Rodeo, which makes it hard for the sea from five, six, and seven rows back. We take bleachers from the schools as well as our bleachers, but they're only about four high. So the issue is we don't have elevated seating for people. We've looked into getting that, and the closest place is Ohio that would do that for a rental, which is a long, expensive way away for a one-day event. Next page. So this page just kind of tells you the breakdown of the revenues and expenses and what we've done in the past. As you can see, we're about $10,000 over what we normally do. But as I mentioned, we are about $5,000 more in two areas, which put us there. Any questions? Next page. So here is the special needs event that you were talking about, Ms. Booker, where Bad Amusements, they do this on their own. They do not charge us for this, and they do not expect to be paid for it. They open their rides up for 2 hours with their staff to provide a service for this community. They only do this one other place, I've been told. So we are one of the two locations that they go through all year that they will do this for the community. And what ended up happening is E.W. Thomas usually provides pizzas. This year, S&N Communications, they made actually chicken nuggets, burgers, and fries for kids. So we had a different experience for the kids than we normally do. And they also feed the carnival ride people, so they get fed as part of a thank you for opening the rides up. And I just want to thank Wade Parish Valley Amusements, S&N Communications, the schools, the Fair Board, and my staff for helping put on this event, because it's a two-hour event. And I'll be honest with you, I woke up Friday morning and I was like, I forgot we had a special needs day. So at 9:30 we are moving to get it moved on and moving ahead. So it is a great event for the community.
Nice. You have a lot of free things for the kids too. The bouncy house.
Yep.
And the corn place.
The corn pit. Yep. So that is something that the Fair Board does provide for the community, where they don't they can pay the $3 to get in. If they don't have the $20 to go get an armband, they have two bounce houses. We had a corn pit.
You had a maze thing too.
The Match Naturalists built a maze back at the Farm Museum. We have the barrel train that runs for free on Saturdays. I think three chop Rotans drove that for us. They didn't ask for anything. So we do try to provide some free things as long as some paid things for our people for our patrons that come. And if we didn't charge, we couldn't put on some of these things, because the Fair Board has to get their money back. Is why we usually charge.
Hey, I had a good time on the merry-go-round. I hadn't been on the like a little kid.
And
I didn't get on the horse.
I would tell you, the Virginia Giant, that was one of our big attractions this year. First time we've ever had that. It's a monster truck where you put 12 people in the back of it, and you take about
seats.
Seats in the back of it. Yeah. And I think I had a picture. And you take a ride. It's about a 5-minute ride. Mm-hmm. I was on the last ride, and it's awesome. They will be back next year. We will be bringing cars that we can ride over. They have like a little track, so they will be back. And we had 430 guests in 3 hours ride that thing. And we had a kid that came all the way from Richmond, and he almost didn't get on it because we shut it down. So I was going to give him my seat. But people come from all around to do this attraction. And it's a big attraction. And we charge $10, and most places charge $20 to $30 for this ride. And they still made their money back being able to do that in 3 hours. Home Arts. So Home Arts was a big success this year. Without the Sorrels, it wouldn't have been done because they're basically without Nina Moreau is the only other person that helped them. Without that, they wouldn't have been done. As you can see, they aren't sure if they're willing to come back next year because they have to take 2 days off from work and get no help and have to run all this stuff. And it's hard for somebody in the community to be able to do that and lose money when they're not really getting anything back.
He is a judge for the meals.
Yep.
I can think of one other person they might be able to get to volunteer to eat for free.
Well, we want...
Not me.
Huh?
Not me, but might have a similar...
That's fine. We are going to be looking for volunteers this next year. Next slide. Any more questions about Home Arts? If everything goes right, we're going to have to expand to the third shed for Home Arts next year because we filled up those two. And they are donated sheds, so from a company. This is our fair board this year. As you can see, there are about 8 people that are not county workers. That is a lot for a fair board to try to put on by themselves. And with my staff, it's almost impossible now because of what we're attracting. We're growing every year. It's a good thing, but the fair board is at a point where they almost don't know if they want to be able to come back to help next year because of the pressure it puts on them with their jobs. So we need to find a way to help the fair board out with this event, if possible, to keep it here. Mr. Dahl, he got a hold of 2-3 finance people on Friday night at midnight to come out Saturday to help us take money, or we wouldn't have been able to take money, from 4 to 8. I called on Melinda Payne. She works for me. 2 of her daughters came out, volunteered their time to take money. It's the only way we were able to take money for those 4 hours. We were strapped. I was in a parking lot. Like I said, I was on 53 parking cars halfway down 53. So we need a lot of help. I'm not sure what I was going to say. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that have you tried reaching out to other nonprofit organizations in the area, as Knights of Columbus, Rotary Club,
Academy
etc.?
Boys.
Yes. The Academy is not back yet.
Right.
That is an issue with us.
A lot of times they'll provide volunteers if they know they're going to get some sort of.
So. The Fluvanna Leadership Development helped us a little bit this year. These are all paid. We paid them to do these. They helped with the beer garden. They helped for 1 day. We had the Band Boosters. They helped pour beer. We had the Ruitans at the Welcome Gate.
And the Legion.
And the American Legion at the Welcome Gate. So we are reaching out to some of those groups. But not everybody is wanting to do it. And we even tried to pay people this year. People didn't want to work. We tried to pay somebody $100 for 3-4 hours to come park cars. We couldn't get anybody to do it. So the county is going to need help. And my thought is all the money that I raise goes back to the general fund. So I want to see if other county departments can help us and not just the Parks and Rec Department. Because it is a county event, not a Parks and Rec event or a county fair event. It is for the community.
Yeah.
The next slide has pictures when you're ready. Now you're good. That's just the pictures from the fair. Sorry I didn't have any 4-H information, but I wasn't able to get that from Ms. Mayo. So we can try to get some. I think they had about 30 animals, if I'm not mistaken. Ranges from sheep to cows to chickens to rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
they had more participation this year than they did last year. So we are always growing. And they had the Virginia Agmobile. Remember last year we had the Artmobile, I think, where you could go and look at artwork, digital artwork. This year they had the Agmobile, where you could go and look at different agricultural kind of stuff and take a slide out the mobile when you're done. There's some of the bands we had on there, and then the pep rally. That's kind of what I showed us, the beer truck. That's what our beer truck looked like in our beer garden. As you can see, there's a line, and there was almost always a line. We did a lot of people. I think they did 700-some people in 2 days, which is really good. We did like 500 people on Saturday, over 500 people Saturday. That's a lot of people. Yeah. And I think the beers were $7 a piece. So It's not bad. Any questions?
Great.
The only thing I'd say is, Aaron and I will both remember this during the whole fair experience, and I meant to actually catch up with you before the board meeting a little bit, but there were two items that came up from one organization that they were questioning whether things were policy or not, and one of them, I think, Aaron, the first one was, when the cutoff was to get signed up, right?
Yep.
In order to put a tent up. And other one was, I think, the first morning of, no, Friday morning, is whether items could be handed out.
Yes.
And I know that because I was getting on a boat in Deltaville.
I was on a call with you.
One of the things I got out of that is if we're going to have citizens that are saying, and more on the handing out of stuff, if we're going to have citizens saying, or if we're going to say to citizens, you can't do these things and we'll have to remove you if you do, they need to be policy. We need to be sure where the clear and written policy.
We have never let anybody come during our special needs time to even set up their own booth in the fair. It is outside of fair time. It's not during fair hours. It's only for the special needs community. Okay. So it is not the time to go in there to ask for stuff from them. It's their time to enjoy themselves.
So I was thinking you were saying during the entire fair, people aren't allowed to hand people.
You can't at your booth. You cannot walk around and hand stuff out.
Is that policy?
Yeah. It is stated in our fair board rules. It is stated in our rules. No, and if not?
Yeah, I mean, from the fair board, I mean, no, the county doesn't have a policy that says you can't hand stuff out. But I mean, there's a reason that the county is requesting that any vendors have to sign up in advance.
Sure.
I mean, because there's that's your time. If you want to go out there and solicit business or whatever you want to do, then get a booth.
And you get your 10 by 10 spot. And that way we don't have everybody coming out there trying to solicit everybody walking up and down.
I hear you. And when I talked to you that Friday, you were unsure if that was written anywhere.
I'll find it. I'm almost sure it's somewhere.
But
it will be written for next year.
My point is, if we're going to say to citizens, stop. And, you know, I had him on one phone, and the citizen calling me on the other phone, as he knows, because they're standing right beside each other. And for me to, as somebody... And look, I know I don't run the fair and all that, but you called me first, and then he called me. For a citizen to say he's not letting me do, then we got to have a policy that says, some sort of policies that are written that say what can and what can't.
We don't ever let anybody go into our special needs day, though.
I understand.
And that is unique.
But I asked you if it was for the whole fair, and you said... That I think you didn't.
You can't solicit for the whole fair. You have to have a booth. But we never let any vendor set up during the special needs day because that is for them and not for information to be given out to them for anything.
Right.
Because that is their some of them. We had one girl. She ran into one of the games where you shoot. They let her go in the game. They let her do some stuff behind. And it takes a lot of people to go help somebody like that. We don't have the time to help vendors there for that. And that is one of the reasons why I asked them to leave that day. We don't allow any vendors in there for our special needs day. It is during our fair hours. And I let them stay on the state-maintained road. because I can't not let them do that.
So, again, the conversation you and I had that day wasn't specific about that the type of people coming in that day. As you said, the general rule, you haven't allowed that throughout the fair. And if that's going to be there, I'm just saying there's got to be some sort of written policies in order to support them. Somebody coming in, let's say they tried to do it on Saturday, they don't know whether you've let other people or not. They're a citizen.
If they're walking down handing out brochures,
right,
then I'm going to tell them that they need to go because they don't have a vendor spot and that they can't do that.
I understand.
And they need to respect you.
There needs to be a policy saying, I
know it somewhere because we say you have to. That's why we give you a 10 by 10 space, so you can't go and hand out your literature. And I will find it, and I will send it to you.
No,
so it is somewhere.
I got it.
Kelly found it.
I know it is somewhere.
Okay. It's in the rules that is on the county fair page, and it's listed under supporting documents, 2022 County Fair Guide, rule number 6, posting and carrying of signs shall be restricted to vendor space only. So I knew
we did it.
I was just going to tell you, the first time I ran for office, I rented a space because I can tell you that this policy has been around for a long time. My space was back behind the existing stage somewhere, and so not many people were making it by to see me. So I started walking around stuff on, and I was asked, "You need to go back to your box."
I'm not against.
So I'll just say it, that I don't know if it's written. Well, Kelly's found it.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not against the policy. I'm just trying. All I was saying was I want to be sure if I've got to defend it to the citizens that I can say that things like that are.
I guarantee you.
And at the time that you and I had last had a conversation about it, you weren't sure if it was in
yep,
there.
Yep, I know. I guarantee you there will be a deadline date on the registration form this year. It's usually up, and I think it got left off.
Yeah.
But we have to have our stuff into the health department 14 days, I think, prior to an event, all food and all that, so that they can be looked at to be certified if they have the permits. So if I can't let a food person in after 14 days, I should not be able to let any other person in after 14 days because it's not fair. And I try to do for one, I do for all. I think I told you that when I was out there.
And I'm not questioning any one of your policies.
So I try to do what I do for one, I try to do for all. So if I can't let a food person in, then I should not be able to let a non-food person in because of they can't get in because of that policy.
What about carrying a weapon?
Huh?
You have any policy on weapons? There were some people that had weapons.
So there was one. I saw open carry,
I saw one guy.
I saw one girl. He saw a guy. I know there's a couple that conceal carry because I know who they are and I know what they did. I will tell you something. I went beginning of this month and I got my concealed carry permit. Mm-hmm. Because if a citizen could be out there with a gun, how am I supposed to protect myself, my staff, or a patron in the park that I'm responsible for if I don't have protection? But it's in our county policy that I'm not allowed to carry a gun while I'm employed for the county, in my car, on my person, or in a park.
So Fred, so somebody brought this up to me after, and of course people will quote law without being able to quote it. And I had people saying it's a right on government property to be able to carry a firearm.
That was addressed last year's General Assembly. And I can't remember the exact terms of it, but it's broadened the authority of localities to restrict carrying firearms on county property.
There are a few places in the state of Virginia that don't allow it. I know Northern Virginia's like Albemarle County does not allow it in their parks, or Charlottesville. There are some local, I looked it up after, there are some places that don't allow open or concealed carry in their parks.
That has changed. It's changed for the more restrictive.
But
so just to be clear, we can say that can't be at the fair.
Unless it's a policy.
I looked that up recently.
I don't think it was us that put it out. That was not allowed.
It was the fair board that posted that, and we changed it within
short
minutes, probably of a phone call. But
the board would have to approve that.
Yes.
That it can or approve that it can't?
That it can't.
That it can't, because they can.
Cannot.
Okay. The board must approve a policy that says you cannot carry firearms on any county property or any specified county property. Mr. Spitzer wouldn't have the authority to adopt that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a policy already that employees cannot, but there's not a policy that general citizens.
So, at this question, so in the case of this at the fair, those people carrying the firearms, for county staff to have said you can't come in here with that firearm would have been unlawful.
We would not have done that.
Yeah,
I'm asking the question.
Yes.
That is unlawful to have done so without there being a policy from the board.
Well, it's not authorized, right?
Yes.
It can't be a county regulation unless it's approved by the board.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
So we suggested that they don't need it. We had a vendor.
Excuse me. Until, I think it was last year, the board didn't have the authority to adopt that. That's what I'm saying. The statute was amended recently.
And this board is not, correct?
I hope not.
Yeah.
Not that I know of. So
I've been known to carry myself.
Personally, I think if citizens are going to be able to carry it, this might not be, but I think as an employee, I should be able to carry on our property. Because what is their safety better than mine? Personally. But that's a different fight. Different argument to go over because it's going to have to be a policy change in our handbook. But I think that's something that needs to be looked at because if I can't protect myself and somebody else can carry a gun on the property, what are we doing? You know what I'm saying? And you don't want to see me carrying a gun on my side.
You don't want to get into that debate tonight.
You don't.
Yes, we're getting a little bit past the fair report.
But that was part of it.
That was a question.
It was a question.
That was a question.
I might have been part of the phone call.
Yeah.
Yep. But we handled whatever was questioned. We changed the statement that was made to say that it is allowed. We just kind of asked. But like I said, I had a vendor. They wanted to carry. I said, well, you probably don't need to be here if you think you need to carry. You know what I'm saying? That's not what we want to show our people, that a vendor sitting there carrying while you're coming up talking to them. It intimidates people.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. All right. Any other questions, Mr. Spitzer?
Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir. Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Have a good night.
Yes, sir. You will. Now we'll move forward with the consent agenda. I, minutes of August 27th, 2022, planning retreat. J, minutes of September 7th, 2022, Ms. Lease. K, CRMF, FMS, BACORP, vandalism and theft reimbursement, Mr. Striblin. L, FY22, Sheriff's Office budget transfer, Ms. Melton. M, FY23, Fluvanna County Public Schools, grants, supplemental appropriation, Ms. Gillum. N, proclaiming October as Community Planning Month, Mr. Miles. Is there anything y'all would like to pull from the consent agenda?
Mr. Chair, if I can just add one thing. Mrs. Eager called the office earlier, and there were some date corrections that we needed to make on the September 7th minutes, so we've made those. So
they have been edited?
They have been edited.
I was going to mention that it seems to me that maybe the process that was referred to as never having amended the minutes is something that isn't very clear in the minutes itself, because I know for a fact that we have many times.
Mr. Weaver called us many times.
And so therefore, when Mr. Corbin was referring to the fact that in 10 years the minutes have never been amended, it seemed that that statement was not accurate, because the minutes have been amended multiple times, just as they were to this point. You just did it retroactively. So I think maybe we need a note in the minutes that we are amending the minutes. Something like that.
Was he talking about amending the comment section?
No,
he's talking about the minutes.
There was the word, without getting too deep, there was a piece of verbiage in the minutes. If they were approved, and then we came back at a subsequent meeting and amended the minutes to change one word in the minutes to more appropriately reflect what the reason why Mr. O'Brien was not at the meeting. And so we amended the minutes at that point.
Which, and since that's been brought up once again for the public record and can be pulled up in the FOIA request, I contacted both the staff and the attorney in advance and asked whether I could be excused for the purpose of going to a funeral. So it was, while it was maybe not mentioned in the original set of minutes, it was certainly mentioned in advance of that meeting.
By the way, just in case anybody's interested, I looked up the actual resolution, and the resolution, it was resolution number 12-2020, and it was adopted the 18th day of March 2020, and it's on the website.
It's under the Board of Supervisors page at the bottom. There's something that says supporting documents, and we added it down there.
Can we please be sure that Mrs. Curley has that?
Can we just make sure we forward that?
Sure.
All right. Do I have a motion to adopt the consent agenda with the changes edited by Ms. Eager?
I move that we adopt the consent agenda with the changes made.
Second.
Motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. All right, let me turn my paper over. Unfinished business, is there any? I don't believe so. Any new business? I don't believe so. I will now open the second round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board, please state your name, address. Keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Is there anyone wishing to speak to the board at this time? I see no one inside approaching. Is there anyone wishing to speak? I see no hands raised. I will now close the second round of public comment. Mr. O'Brien?
Mr. Chair, I move the Sylvania County Board of Supervisors to enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2-3711A3, Section 2.2-3711A5, Section 2.2-3711A7 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended for the purposes of discussing real estate, support union real estate acquisition, prospective industry, prospective business, litigation, actual litigation in connection with the Zions Crossroads Water and Sewer Project.
I second that motion.
We have a motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. We are now in closed session.
Chair, I move to close meeting be adjourned and the Sylvania County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge one only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion's made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mrs. Booker. Does anybody else see Mr. O'Brien turn the same color as his shirt? Mr. Fairchild?
Yes.
Vote. We got to vote by one. You're now first. You're on that end.
Vote what?
To have a closed meeting.
To come out of closed session.
Just say aye.
Aye. I didn't hear it as a motion. So.
No. These, and Ms. Booker?
Aye.
Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. We are now out of closed session. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
I move we adjourn.
Sayonara, second that one.
All right, Ms. Booker is making the motion. Mr. O'Brien is seconding the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passed 5-0. We are